Coming up on This Week in Tech, I am Micah Sargent subbing in for Leo Laporte while he's on vacation, and I have a great show planned for you. We've got the Swiftie panel. It's Christina Warren, Senior Developer Advocate at GitHub, Alex Wilhelm, reporter at TechCrunch, and Abrar Alhiti, video host and producer for CNET. And we've got a lot to talk about. We start off the show running down some April Fool's gags that kind of turns into just a desire to have fun back on the internet. Then we hit AI. There's a lot to talk about, including that open letter regarding AI and how it's dangerous. Was what they said true? And were the people who actually signed the letters truly the people who signed the letters? We also talk about Twitter, some certain celebrities getting boosted, where we might go outside of Twitter, how we wish that we could return to how Twitter used to make us feel. And we complain a little about GM deciding that CarPlay and Android Auto are not worth keeping around in future electronic vehicles. It's all that, plus so much more, coming up on This Week in Tech.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit, This Week in Tech, hosted this time by Micah Sargent, episode 921, recorded Sunday, April 2nd, 2023, the Swiftie panel. This episode of This Week in Tech is brought to you by Lookout. Whether on a device or in the cloud, your business data is always on the move. Minimize risk, increase visibility, and ensure compliance with Lookout's unified platform. Visit lookout.com today. And by ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN lets you choose from over 90 different countries. So every time you run out of stuff to watch, you can fire up the app, switch your country, and hit connect. Protect your data. For 3 extra months free with a 1-year package, go to expressvpn.com/twit.
Thanks for listening to this show. As an ad-supported network, we are always looking for new partners with products and services that will benefit our qualified audience. Are you ready to grow your business? Reach out to advertise@twit.tv and launch your campaign now.
It's time for Twit, This Week in Tech, and I am your host this week, Micah Sargent. That's right, as many of you probably already know, because it seems like you've got his calendar in your own phones, Leo Laporte is out as he is on vacation and will be for most of this month. We will have several guest hosts of Twit while he is away, and today it just so happens to be me, and I'm so excited. This is my first time hosting This Week in Tech, and I've got a great panel prepared for you. First off, video host and producer for CNET and my fellow Midwesterner, or at least original Midwesterner, it's Abrar Alhiti. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be on.
Yeah, it's great to get you back on the show, and I'm looking forward to chatting with you. We are also joined across, some level of distance by Senior Developer Advocate at GitHub. It's Christina Warren. Hello.
Hello. Hello. It's so good to be back, and it's so good to see you like in the big hosting chair. I love this. I love this so much. You and I have known each other for such a long time, and I feel like this is like, I love this. I just love seeing you in the big hosting chair.
It is a milestone. I'm living it up right now, I got to tell you. And I am also excited to be joined by a reporter at TechCrunch, but honestly, just an all-around swell guy. It's Alex Wilhelm. Welcome back to the show, Alex.
Thank you for having me. I just want to say, Micah, you look amazing. The haircut, the fit, overall, you just look like you're glowing. Shout out,
man. Oh, my goodness.
Tremendous.
Thank you so much. Wow. It's such a kind panel today. I think it's a kind panel a lot of the time. I wanted to start the show off by, I guess it's going to be a bit of a throwback, because I remember a day where I would have to remind myself every night before April 1st rolled around to be very, very careful when I logged onto the internet the next day that I didn't believe anything that was happening, because there were April Fool's jokes aplenty and lots of different online sites had lots that they wanted to share. And this year, in fact, this morning I thought, oh my goodness, did anything happen on April Fool's Day? So I thought I'd ask the panel if any April Fool's pranks from tech companies stuck out to you. And I think, Alex, you said there was one that caught your eye.
Yeah, it was actually kind of a failed April 1st prank because Elon Musk promised that everyone with a legacy Twitter blue checkmark was going to lose it. And I woke up yesterday morning waiting to see the demise of my verified status, only to find out that apparently not technically possible. So as of before the show, still verified. So I guess Elon Musk pranked himself.
That's a good one. That's a good one. Did anyone else see anything? Abrar, I was wondering if you knew if TikTok did anything for April Fool's Day.
Oh, that's a great question. I didn't see anything. I would have because I spend ungodly hours on that app. But I also Twitter was the main thing for me too. That was like the first thing I did when I woke up also, where I was like, is that blue check still there? And it is. And then I was thinking, okay, I guess they said they're going to start taking away the verify, like it would start on April 1st. So I'm kind of still just watching, but that was really where my attention was. But TikTok, I'm kind of disappointed, honestly. Like, I don't know if we're all just, are we all over being pranked? I don't know. I don't know what's going on, but.
I thought I was, but its absence makes the heart grow fonder. So I'm feeling about it.
Right?
It's all gone away. And I'm going, where's the life on the internet? Christina, especially working at one point at Mashable, I'm sure covered lots of April Fool's Day pranks. Where did they all go?
Yeah, I didn't see many either. And I wonder, like, I feel like part of it is that, like, there is this part where, like, it had been this fun sort of activity and you would see companies do really creative things. And then as what almost always happens, the brands like ruin it. They just go too far.
Yeah.
And it gets to the point where like it crosses over from being kind of cute to being cringe. And that happened a number of years ago, but I'm with you now. I am disappointed like TikTok didn't do something or that, you know, TikTokers didn't try to do something. I did see one video, Linus Tech Tips, that YouTube channel, they made like a funny video about like Linus, like basically starting a farm of some sort. And I watched part of the video. I'll be honest, I was like not completely paying attention, but it seemed funny. But it was obvious that it was a joke.
Yeah. So maybe that's what it requires, is whenever it exists in that middle space where those of us who know sort of are steeped in technology, where we are going, oh no, the people are going to be fooled by this and it's going to result in us having to sort of explain. And remember Volkswagen's April Fool's Day joke where they like lied to journalists?
Thinking about that.
Oh, that was bad. That was bad. It was Volkswagen, right?
Oh, yeah. Okay, but hear me out though. Okay. I think the internet back in like 2012, 2013 was fun because it was less high stakes because these companies weren't $1 trillion businesses. Many of them were kind of on the come up. There were fewer total people in tech, it felt like. So like a joke had more resonance. And then everything got a little bit brandified, as you said. But I kind of missed the, and I know this is not the right phrasing, but the more innocent era of fun on the internet.
Yes.
When it was more your friends hanging out. And now Twitter is just like a fire.
Completely. Well, also like, but I was with you, Alex, when Elon said that they're getting rid of all the check marks and it would start on April 1st. I was like, have you ever been online ever? Because this is okay. So the day that you're going to take away all the verification to say who is, you know, who, like whatever you want to say about verification, is it obviously it's been a status symbol and it has been, you know, meaningless for a long time, but it also has to a certain extent been like, well, yeah, this person is this person. Okay. So you're going to get rid of that on like the one day of the year where the internet goes crazy anyway. It's like, have you ever been online? This seems like this is just, you know,
was it Meta or was it intentional or was it just completely detached and misunderstanding entirely? Yeah, I was confusing no matter what. I do sort of, I'm a little sad. I will say a network that I'm a part of, the Relay FM network, where I have a podcast called Clockwise. They did, as they do every year, a little April Fool's Day joke where they pretend to launch a couple of shows. And so this year there were a couple of shows that were not actual shows that were going to be launched, including one that was like a nature podcast where you just heard the sounds of nature, which I was like, you know what? I don't think I would hate that. That might be kind of nice. And then
or just go drive somewhere, like literally go to a field.
Yeah, that's
there.
True. Very true. That's the podcast.
Yeah, that's a lot more work though.
True, but I do appreciate that Relay FM apparently did an inverse NPR. They launched fake shows and NPR canceled real ones.
Oh, rest in peace.
Oh.
Now, how many shows did they cancel?
I didn't have a follow-up there. That was just me being sad.
Yeah, I mean, we got to pour one out. Well, no, I won't pour this out, but I'll pretend to pour it out for the shows. Speaking of stuff that I think was a little bizarre, a little hard to understand. In fact, there was one site that said, we thought it was an April Fool's Day joke. Did y'all hear the one about GM deciding that they weren't going to be offering CarPlay and Android Auto in future cars? What?
Yes.
What? So quickly, GM, which of course Chevrolet is one of kind of their main car lines, they have seemed to decide that in the future, their electric vehicles are not going to support third-party infotainment systems like CarPlay and like Android Auto. And they are going with sort of a more in-house, although it's through Google, infotainment system that is built into the car as opposed to being a projection system where when you plug in your phone, it sends all of that information to your car's system and displays that information. And I have to tell you, when I first heard this, I talked a little bit about it this morning on Ask the Tech Guys, I was a little bit beside myself because it seemed like I remember seeing a study or a survey about people who, when they were making a car decision, along with, of course, electric vehicle being part of what they were thinking about, it was the car's infotainment system that was super important to them. I'm curious, have any of you bought or thought about buying a car or are thinking about buying a car? And like, how important is, even in your current car, the infotainment system for you?
I mean, so we had a dumb car, like equivalent of a dumb phone for a long time. Mm-hmm. And then Ladybug, our beloved Volvo S40, started to shake at like 50 miles an hour. So she had to go. And we bought Bob the Subaru. We name our cars. I don't know why. And it has Apple CarPlay. And it's like magic. It's the best thing ever. I can play Taylor Swift at like max volume in the car. And like, it's amazing. And then I read this and I was like, the thing I just discovered is already being phased out. Is this what middle age feels like?
No, I mean, so I don't drive, but if I were to buy a car for someone else to drive me around in it, like it would be an absolute requirement for it to have, you know, CarPlay. And it's interesting because you mentioned that, Micah, about a survey showing that that's what people look for. This has actually been the case for more than a decade. I remember being on a panel with some people from Ford more than 10 years ago. And back then they had a bunch of futurists that they, you know, employed to kind of look at next trends. And they were already seeing the fact that the average age of people getting their driver's license was increasing, which is obviously bad for car companies. But they were looking at, like, back then, one of the big, you know, pressing things, and this was even before Android Auto and CarPlay, was the infotainment system and how connected that can be. And there was this big movement, you know, but amongst the car companies to actually, many of them had their own systems that were of various levels of smart, and they wound up seeding, most of them wound up seeding it to Android Auto or CarPlay, frankly, A, because it was cheaper, and B, because the interface was better and people wanted it enough. But I mean, like my mom, she has a fairly recent Mercedes, but it does not have, for whatever reason, when she got it, didn't have the CarPlay option. Whoa. My dad's new car does. And she hates it so much. So when she gets a new car, like that is, she's like made it very clear, like it has to have CarPlay. So it is so odd to me that they're talking about dropping this for these new EVs, like models that already have them will keep them, but the new ones won't. I'm like, what are you doing? Because even if you make this relatively easy for someone to connect their phone to, if it has a worse user experience, and let's be honest, it will, like, how long is this going to go on? This feels just like such a dumb move.
Yeah.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think that's the thing. I think it's like the fact that this is something that is kind of slowly picking up steam. A lot more people are becoming a lot more attached to things like CarPlay and Android Auto. And then to to not allow that to really stick and already be like, oh, we're doing something different now. For me, the last car I had was a 2012 Corolla. So it's been a minute, and I sold that when I moved out to the Bay Area. So I did not have any of this. But every time you get in somebody's car, they have one of these systems, and it's, you know, integrated with their phones, and it makes the process a lot more seamless. They're less likely to kind of, you know, pick up their phone and check it if they can kind of see everything that's going on. So I don't know, this is kind of a strange move.
Well, and as Christina pointed out, by doing that, they're letting the other company, the car manufacturers, letting the other companies worry about all of that stuff. So if up to this point, you've made so many cars that have this functionality built in, which is essentially just a video connection between point A and point B and a little bit of data being sent back and forth. It's so easy to do that. So to actually now invest the time and money into having a system that's built into the car as opposed to just being projected from the phone is so much more work. But the Verge article points out the thing that really drives this home, a pun, is that this is, thank you. This is all about the companies, GM specifically, getting so much more data on the drivers. They, especially if you offer an infotainment system that on top of doing music and mapping and everything else, it also is looking at your fuel economy. It's looking at how fast you're going, all of that stuff. They suddenly have this data that they can use and make all sorts of opportunities for marketing and everything else. And I think in that way, it makes sense. And then there's also the factor of subscriptions, they can start to offer subscriptions.
That's it.
This is the worst thing for consumers I can possibly imagine. It's going to be an operating system by GM with Google parts glued together by people who've never built an OS before, designed to upsell you and sell your data while not connecting to your iPhone. Fantastic.
What a
brilliant idea. This is literally driven by people in accounting who want to squeeze 100%. Margin out of cars. And it makes me want to vomit it into my hands. But before we get on to more serious things, Christina doesn't drive. I don't drive. Abrar doesn't have a car. This is the least mobile panel I've ever been on. My spouse does. I've driven our car once across a parking lot, literally one time, and it scared me. So go team.
Interesting. Oh, man. So you don't drive now, Abrar, but being from the Midwest, you drove more often.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
It was the only way to get around, especially in like a smaller town. I feel like moving out to the Bay, it was kind of a no-brainer to not have a car. But now I feel like everyone has a car in the Bay now. I don't know.
It does seem like that, doesn't it?
Right. Post-pandemic, I think something changed. But I'm still holding on to the no car lifestyle because I don't want to deal with the traffic and the parking and the break-ins.
Yeah, putting signs in that say, please don't take any, there's nothing in here of value. It's not.
And they, at least in Seattle, they don't follow that. They don't care.
They're still on it.
In our covered, like, building that I live in that is like locked and whatnot, like my husband's car has been broken into multiple times and he doesn't even have a nice car. They leave the Teslas alone, but they go straight for, you know, the 2004 Volvo.
Too bad.
Yeah.
It's too bad.
But no, it is. Yeah. Even with the signs, like, please don't do this. But I was going to say, you're exactly right, Alex. Like, this is a subscription play. But what is so dumb about this, and I get them wanting to go all in on subscriptions, there's an argument you could make where you could, like, lock the access to the CarPlay or the Android Auto behind some sort of GM subscription. It would still be gross, but you could do that. And I would honestly prefer that to what this is going to be, which is, as you said, their own, like, kind of hobbled together operating system from people who've never built an OS. And because they're probably going to want to have, like, their own, like, system on a chip system here because it's not a projection, it's not going to get updates. And it's going to become obsolete. And people keep their cars for longer than you keep your phone. So the nice thing about CarPlay and Android Auto and whatnot is, yes, at a certain point, maybe they will become a little bit too decrepit to, like, work all the way. But you'll still be able to have basic things where parts of the screen will be able to display, you know, this is the song that's playing or this is the maps thing because it is just a display thing. And that's going to go away here. And so I'm guessing that in another decade, we will see all these GM original, you know, OS things that didn't work out. They will just, another bean counter will come and go, oh, well, it's cost us too much money to try to maintain all these things. So now we're just going to partner up with the operating system manufacturers, the phones, and go back to the old way again.
Yeah.
It just seems so short-sighted.
It is kind of frustrating to me thinking about what the next 5-10 years looks like in terms of how many subscription services are going to be hitting my account every month. But it is the way that companies are doing things, and even companies that are who at one point the agreement was you buy a thing and you spend a good amount of money on that thing, and then it is your thing and you have it and you can use it, to now every little piece and part of it has a subscription that's built into it. I remember, this is a little silly, but I was really excited about, they had these little sort of robot friends, and the little robot friend you could get, and it had like a little face and it would respond to you, and it had a little home where it would go and charge itself, and it could like show you the weather, and it was a little goofy, but it was kind of a fun little toy. And I thought, oh, I might have to get one of those. You know, it's a bit of an investment, but it'll be fun to have, and it drives around your house and is cute. And then I saw, oh, on top of buying the device itself, which is already pretty pricey, you have to pay $10 a month to be able to continue to use it and use all of the features that it has. It's like, is anything not subscription-based?
Okay, can I throw in one car-based subscription counter-argument to our consensus here?
Please, yeah.
Okay, I have to buy a car eventually and actually relearn how to drive at some point in time, because being a one-car family... Same. With a little human is stretching our ability to not lose our minds. There's this like three-wheel electric car coming out that's like a motorcycle in a case, essentially. And it's tiny, and it's like a good little one-person city car. And that's all I need around Providence, where the streets are really narrow. And you can buy it, or you can rent it for like $200 a month later this year. And I'm thinking, ooh, why not? Like, I don't need, I don't want to buy a depreciating asset anyways, really. So why not just essentially lease this e-car? And I can be the biggest dork in town, and mm-hmm. no one will like me.
Pay for that privilege.
It's fine. Yeah, I mean, I don't leave the house much anyway, so I don't really care. But like, to me, that's kind of cool, because I don't want to go out and spend $25,000 or $50,000 on a car, because apparently it got really expensive since I bought my last one.
Lord have mercy.
Yeah, so I think maybe for some things they're okay, but if you buy a car, it should be yours. I hate turning everything into an asset that you don't actually own. Even though I get the corporate America perspective, I just think it sucks.
Yes, copy and paste exactly that. I get it, but I don't like it. So one other thing that kind of exists in this bizarre space we were kicking the show off with, I don't know if you all heard about, I'm sure you did, that open letter about AI, where the several signatories were saying, hey, look, we think that any AI technology that is more advanced than GPT-4, we should put a pause on that. We should put a pause at least 6 months on investigating and trying to create AI that's any better than this. And we need to just be more mindful of the fact that there are dangers to this AI. And then, of course, as it got shared around, look at the people that are on this list. It's Steve Wozniak. It's Elon Musk. It's all of these different AI researchers. It's the co-creator or the CEO of FTX, Sam Bankman-Fried. It is all of these different people. It turns out, according to Vice, that several of the people on the list who were quote unquote confirmed were not actually the people who were on the list, but instead were fake people who said that they were the people who were on the list and confirmed that they wanted their names signed. And then on top of that, after the letter was released, there were several people who did sign the list or the letter who said, hey, actually, we don't agree with many of the points in the letter. So I don't know if they didn't have time to read it and they just decided to sign it or what was going on there. But this whole thing is a mess. And this Vice piece kind of goes into depth about the research that Vice did itself. And then I think overall about a conversation surrounding the potential dangers of AI, but also the conversation around AI. And that, I think, is the bigger deal here. Last Thursday, I had, I believe it was from the Washington Post, we had an incredible guest on who talked about talking about AI and the pitfalls that we often fall into, and sort of creating a, we know about news literacy, but this was about AI literacy. And in helping people to understand what AI can and can't do in its current state, what it could possibly do, and helping to deal with the fears surrounding AI and sort of what's manageable and what's not. But I wanted to get the panel's take on this open letter, what we're all feeling about generative AI, particularly for many of us, as journalists, and then even as developers and developer advocates, and maybe even, Christina, what you've heard from developers, because I know Microsoft itself is working on even making further improvements to, for example, Copilot, and what the sort of sentiment is about where AI is right now and where it's going. So why don't we start with Christina, and then I'd love to hear from the both of you as well.
Yeah, so the one, I guess, kind of disclosure that I will make is that I work at GitHub, who has a relationship with OpenAI to make a GitHub Copilot. And Microsoft is our parent company, and they are very involved in this stuff too. I think that there are definitely reasons to be cautious, and I can understand the point that the letter, putting aside all the mess about who really was signing it and who wasn't aside, I can understand some of the, I guess, fear, or at least the need to want to maybe take a pause on things. But the letter as I read it seems to me is completely misguided in some ways. I think in some ways it overhypes and overbuys into some of the realities of where AI is now versus like where it might be in 5 years. In 5 years, maybe these fears would be more applicable. But I think right now this is buying into a reality that we're just not seeing. And I'm going to be honest, I think some of the people who've signed the letter, who have, you know, maintained that they've signed it, are coming at this from, like, it strikes me as a little bit hypocritical, mm-hmm. because these are people who have already invested their own time and money into AI models that maybe aren't as advanced as some of these things are. And so I have to start to question, are you actually worried about humanity, or are you just worried that you are going to be caught flat-footed and that someone else will be able to make more money than you will in the short term? Like that's where the cynic in me is going to go off. I think that we need to have conversations about AI literacy and about what it can and can't do. And I think that we need to have conversations about, you know, how we want these models to evolve. But I don't know if this letter was A, in good faith, or B, is actually representing the future that we're in right now, and not, you know, frankly, a little bit of hype and science fiction of where we might be.
Well put. Alex?
I mean, how can I follow that? Not trying to get Christina in trouble, but one of the things I'm most excited about in the AI world is actually what's going on with Copilot and code generation in general with these large language models, or LLMs. And the reason why is I haven't really written code since high school, when I was learning C++ out of a book that was like this thick. And I didn't make it that far because it was boring. But what I would love to do is be able to build things. And I think that once we get generative code development from these AI tools into a more workable state, I, Alex, am going to be able to build cool things.
Yes.
And that doesn't seem to be that far away.
No.
Is that dangerous? No. It's an extension, I feel, Christina, of kind of like what folks can already do.
Totally. No, I totally agree with you. And we hear a lot of that. I mean, where the code generation is right now is it's not bad. And for some things that would usually come from a book, like a, you know, like you can ask GitHub Copilot right now to write you an application that will play rock, paper, scissors in Python. And it will do that. But that is something that would be in a very basic kind of like introduction to programming book, right? Mm-hmm. Like this is a very simple exercise. And you can ask, you know, ChatGPT and Copilot some other things that will help you maybe generate some code blocks. And but right now it's still a little bit more piecemeal. You still do need to know what you're doing to a certain extent. So that's why we call it a Copilot. It's not doing it for you. It's assisting you. But I do think that we will reach a point where you can have someone who has an idea of this is what I want to do, and I can put together like a minimal viable product that will do this. And some people see this as a threat to their jobs and to the future. I don't, because I think that you've always, what we've seen with when coding languages have become easier to use and people have been able to build more things, we've just seen the explosion in more people wanting to build applications, not fewer. So does that mean that maybe some low level jobs will go away potentially, but I would also question whether those people would have been hired to build those apps to begin with. I think that this could just be an opportunity for people who would have never paid for it and would have otherwise never been able to have the skills to build an application might actually have that opportunity. And that's exciting. Sorry, go on, Alex.
And I think that when you think about GitHub Copilot, it's just one layer higher of abstraction in the code language stack from assembly up through other languages. And right. Then the next step, I think, is kind of no code systems paired yep. with prompts that I say, mm-hmm. please connect this button to that, have it turn purple when I click it. And yep. then the code's done in the background. I don't have to deal with it. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly me, Alex, can do so much more. And that's very exciting as a step forward. I think the letter, going back to Micah's point, is doomerism from fake optimists who are bummed out that they're behind, AKA Elon. So, you know, whatever. But, you know, past that, I'm still very excited about all of this. And I'm going to shut up now and let Abrar go. But like, I just can't believe that the people who claim that everyone else is a bummer about tech are now writing bummer letters about their competitors. Like, lame.
Abrar, what are your thoughts?
I just want to say, I think it's kind of like sadly poetic that like even the people who it appears signed the letter didn't like what is real. Like, none of it's real. It was like, it was kind of like, who knows? But I think I agree with both of your points. And I think the thing that I'm thinking about is that for a lot of us who are in the tech space, we see a lot of the potential here. We see a lot of the dangers here. But I think the scary thing and the point of concern is that this has all just kind of exploded so quickly and from so many angles and from so many companies that I think the fear of misinformation is a real one. And I think, I think it becomes a matter of making sure there's this tendency in tech to just do things because you can. And it makes me wonder in what capacity should we be using these technologies and in what ways can we improve, you know, society and different assets of our lives. But yeah, I think it's also something to think about when you look at the names on here. Okay. Why are these people signing this letter? I think it's very valid to kind of be a little skeptical of that. But I think the biggest thing for me is just thinking about how quickly this has all come together and how the everyday person is going to perceive this and if they're going to be able to tell what's real and what's not, because it's getting a lot harder.
Yes.
Yeah, it's true.
The Washington Post piece that I want to point everyone to was by Tatum Hunter, who joined me on Tech News Weekly to talk about it. And the piece is called Three Things Everyone's Getting Wrong About AI. And although that does have sort of a BuzzFeed style headline that may make you go, I don't want to. No, you should absolutely check this piece out, because one of the things that I felt a little attacked by in this piece, because it was like, oh, this is me. I wasn't even thinking about this. It was how when I would go and I'd talk to ChatGPT, or we'll type to ChatGPT, and it would provide an answer that I could confirm was correct because it was something that I already knew or I was actively kind of looking at, it started to lead me, if I'm seeing it do these things and get it right, then it's starting to put in me this belief that it's going to continue to be correct about things and sort of have this false belief in the system that it's not going to have those issues where then the next time I ask it something, it's hallucinating an answer as opposed to giving me one. And I think that was one aspect of it in particular that really stuck out to me, because while I feel like on from the get-go, because I have some level of understanding of how a large language model works, and because I tend to be skeptical of technology in general, at least in the sense of just inquiring about it, I thought, oh, I'm going to be okay with this. But then to have that moment and go, oh, I need to maintain a certain skepticism that just because it's giving me this answer and it's gotten so many different things correct, I still should follow through and have some due diligence, because if we don't have some level of due diligence, then that is where, and that's the thing, it's misinformation, not disinformation, because it's not that the AI is actively trying to lie to me, but it is just by its nature potentially saying something that is untrue. So yeah, just us being mindful of that, even though because it's kind of like you see, when you see a child start walking for the first time and you're like, oh my goodness, I'm so proud of you. Like, you've done this. You don't suddenly think that they can build a car, or they can suddenly like change the way that nuclear mechanics works or whatever. But when I saw the AI get this small thing right, then suddenly I'm going, oh my goodness, now I can do all of these things and it's going to be great at it. And I, you know, potentially you could find yourself putting too much faith in it. But as in terms of being a an assistant that helps me complete something that I want to do, what you were talking about, Alex, I have used this a number of times. I know just a tiny bit of Python, and it's not enough to do some of the things that I've wanted to do. And so being able to go into ChatGPT and say, hey, this is what I want to do to add on to this, or I couldn't figure out what regular expression I needed to create to be able to pick out some specific text from a document, using it to do that. That stuff is fantastic. It's really good at that. And that is where it is such a help, I think, to humanity, and can potentially like just make so much of a difference for people.
And that's also a sticking point, because I read an interesting, I forget if it was a Twitter thread or a post from someone who contributed a lot to Stack Overflow, which is a place where developers come together often to ask questions and solve things with one another. And they were saying, effectively, I don't want all of my contributions to be hoovered up into the great AI in the sky and then used in ways that I may not approve of or that may not be fair to me. And, you know, reasonable. It smacks a little bit to me of people trying to de-index from Google if you're a site on the internet. So I'm kind of like, is this Ludditeism or is this a reasonable complaint from a person who contributes to an open forum? That I have yet to kind of figure out where I stand. But at the same time, Micah, if you were like, here's the thing, you can use it, I'm going to click the big green button because I personally want to do more stuff. But I am glad we're at least talking about the ethics behind the source materials that are going into these systems. And I think that's where Italy ended up getting kind of peevish about the whole thing.
Absolutely. One last example that I have to give, because I think that this is, again, one of the rare instances, well, not rare instances because it's becoming less rare, but one of the very specific instances where something like a large language model can work. I remembered that there was an episode of either, or there's either an episode of television or there was some movie where in that episode of television or in that movie, there was a person who was taking antidepressant medications and they were living their life. Everything was fine. But at some point, some naturalist had prescribed St. John's wort. And what many of you may know is that if you take St. John's wort, it is one of those rare substances that can actually make your body absorb more of different types of medication. It like makes your body better at absorbing other types of medication. So if you take St. John's wort and an antidepressant at the same time, then you can become at risk for serotonin syndrome, where you end up having too much serotonin in your brain and it causes all sorts of issues. So in the show or the movie, the person started to lose their mind and no one knew why it was happening. And it, lo and behold, it was because they were taking St. John's wort. So I typed into ChatGPT, I know there's a movie or a TV show out there where this happens. And then it was able to respond and be like, yeah, that was this episode of Dr. House.
Amazing.
Did it also happen in Veep? Oh, see, so I've got ChatGPT. No, it was Aunt Pruitt, actually, who's like, this happened in Veep. But there was an episode of Dr. House where that had happened. And yeah, the whole time it was because of the St. John's wort. Anyway, that is just one of those unique situations where because it's hoovered up all of that information, I don't have all of that here. And it was kind of a hard thing to Google. I tried that first and it was just more all of these warnings about taking St. John's wort with the medication. So it's like, oh, okay. That was a great.
Congratulations. You now invented Google back when it was good.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, remember when you could type in Google, like it's that song that goes bum, 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 bum. And Google will be like, oh yes, of course. It's this 1983 rendition of Toto. You're like, oh, fantastic. So if ChatGPT is going to make Google good again, cool. I'm here for it. Google's trash now.
Are we going to get hats that say that? Make Google great again?
Oh, God.
As long as they're not red with white font on the front, because even as a joke, I think I'll pass on the modern KKK helmet.
We'll have ChatGPT design them. Make these the least offensive thing they can possibly be with this tagline. We'll see what it comes
up
with.
It's going to be like a Pikachu hat or something. Something that everyone loves.
All right. I want to take a quick break before we come back with lots more. I've got a great panel. Christina Warren, Alex Wilhelm, and Abrar Alhiti are all here today for this episode of This Week in Tech, which is brought to you today by Lookout. As we have been talking about on the show, and I think as many of you know, business has changed forever because we've seen a change in the boundaries of where we work or even how we work. All those boundaries have kind of disappeared. That means your data, it's always on the move, whether on a device or in the cloud, across networks, at the local coffee shop. And that's great for your workforce because it means you can have people who are working from different places and are able to get their work done no matter what is going on. It's a challenge for IT security, those folks who are trying to make sure that all of that data doesn't make it to the wrong hands. So Lookout is there to help you out with that. It helps you control your data and free your workforce. With Lookout, you're going to gain complete visibility into all your data so you can minimize risk from external and internal threats, plus ensure compliance. By seamlessly securing hybrid work, your organization doesn't have to sacrifice productivity for security, because that's a big thing, right? If we've got all of these folks who are trying to get their work done, but every time they try to log on because they're doing it from a coffee shop or their home network isn't exactly what it's supposed to be, they're hitting all of these roadblocks of, oh, you've got to log into this and you've got to type this in and you've got to do this in order to, that just gets in the way of getting work done. So Lookout makes that simpler. It makes IT security so much easier. Working with multiple point solutions and legacy tools in today's environment, it's too complex. So with its single unified platform, Lookout reduces IT complexity, giving you more time to focus on whatever else comes your way. Good, I love this, good data protection isn't a cage, it's a springboard, letting you and your organization bound toward a future of your making. So visit lookout.com today. Super easy to remember, right? Lookout.com today to learn more on how to safeguard your data, how to secure your hybrid work, and how to reduce IT complexity. That's lookout.com. Thank you, Lookout, for sponsoring this week's episode of This Week in Tech. All right, back from the break, and I think it's time to talk about a big tech company with a big old conference coming up in June. Apple has announced its Worldwide Developer Conference for 2023, a mostly online event with a small sort of special event that's taking place in person. But along with that announcement, of course, comes the slate of rumors that goes along with any Apple announcement. And I think with this one, of course, the way that the Worldwide Developers Conference happens every year is it kicks off with a keynote. And at that keynote, Apple announces the new features, updates, changes that are taking place for all of its software platforms. macOS, tvOS, watchOS, HomePodOS, iPadOS, iOS, etc. And so we will always see software announcements at the event, and then developers spend the rest of the week learning how to make use of these new tools or how to make use of the updates to the existing tools. But there are some rumors, Christina, that Apple is slated to announce maybe its AR VR headset. Is it time for Apple to dip its toe into AR VR?
I mean, I think it would have been better if they did it a couple of years ago. before, you know, the tides kind of shifted. But hey, when it's ready, it's ready. I mean, I definitely want to see what this very long rumored headset looks like. And it certainly seems like from the design of the invitation that we might finally be looking at this. So
who knows?
I guess it's time. I don't know. This feels like, other than the long rumored Apple car, this seems like the most, like the least slam dunk, least makes sense, you know, kind of like big swing, you know, new category Apple thing that I can recall in a really long time. Like the watch was kind of weird, especially when it was first positioned to be this fashion object. They very quickly pivoted that to fitness, and it completely was a massive success. Obviously, phones and tablets make sense. I feel like we're still waiting for whatever the killer app will be. If any company is going to give us a killer app for AR, VR, it will be Apple. But yeah, maybe now it's finally time. And it would be sort of ironic if they were showing it off in this sort of weird hybrid virtual
but also in person world, right?
Like, yeah, because how do you do that, right? And especially with a product that is so focused on sort of the visual aspect of it. Do you have people on stage who are very good at describing what they're seeing?
Right.
Because you can never trust like the virtual demonstrations of these products, because it's not the same as being able to see it quite literally with your eyes, right?
It
always is going to be, is this completely computer generated? Is this what I'm actually seeing? This is a hard product, I think, just in general to launch and to have people trust it enough to where they're willing to spend the money, because that's what we're hearing too, is that this is going to be a pretty pricey object. And Alex, I saw you really rolling that arm in there, so you must have been agreeing.
Sorry. I what I've learned to do in my maturity is not interrupt people, but then I have to not talk. And it's very hard when I have many things that I want to say, but I need to be polite and leave room for others. So anyways, I just want to say that Christina said something very interesting, that there's going to be a keynote, I believe, or maybe that was you, Micah. But they're not keynotes, to your point. They're actually just infomercials.
True.
In the old days, you had to have a device on stage, use it, and have it work. Now everything's so pre-produced. It's like listening to like a really bad pop single when all the personality has been stripped out of it by producers and mixers and masters, to the point to which there's not really much soul left. And so if Apple pulls this off, huzzah, I'll buy it, because, you know, I buy everything that Apple makes eventually. I am skeptical, but I do hope that, like, if they do have something, it's not just what they usually do, which is a lot of glitzy stats on a screen from some dude in a laboratory with a coat on. You know, like, I hope it's a bit more touch and feel. And to that point, when Microsoft first showed off the HoloLens nerd helmet, I got to use it that day. They put me in a room with it. I got to put it on. I got to play with it. Awesome. Mm-hmm. Didn't work out commercially, but the technology was freaking fantastic. So I think you need to have that tactile, real, no BS, no pre-chewed, let me touch it, let me turn it on. Otherwise, I just don't care.
Yeah. Yeah. Because again, what is real? As Abrar was saying earlier, I'm curious for you, Abrar, have you, used any VR devices, and what's your kind of take on VR, AR as it currently stands and where it could go?
It's been years since I last put on what was an Oculus, and it's going. I think this is really the ultimate test to see the power of Apple, because so many companies have been trying so hard to make us want to put a headset on for VR, AR, and this is going to be the ultimate test, not just because of the technology, but also because of the prices you'd mentioned. There are rumors this would cost somewhere around $3,000. That's a lot of money. And so, it's an Apple product. So you're going to pay for it. And I think it's just going to be really interesting to see what the tech looks like and what the adoption looks like. And you think about other things too, like foldable phones. Okay, that's kind of been a slow takeoff. If Apple rolls a lot of foldable phone, will that happen? So there are a couple areas here where there are rumors that Apple is working to create a product. And I am just really curious to see if people are going to be willing to do it. And I think they are. I think they're going to be more likely to put on an Apple headset versus, a Quest Pro. I think there's a lot of skepticism and scrutiny around companies like Meta. And I think also Meta hasn't necessarily sold it very well. Like, why? I still don't understand why you would need or want, that headset. But Apple will find a way to try to convince you to want it. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, to your point about that, if you go back in time before iPhones got larger screens, iPhone users mocked Android users for having phablets, right?
Yes.
Own tablets. Oh my gosh, your screen's
yes,
so big.
Did.
What is that? And that fake iPad? And then Apple screens got bigger and everyone was like, this is the best. And you kind of sit back and you're like, how did they do that? That's magic.
Yeah.
So Abrar, I'm with you. Even if it's 3K, I'm pretty sure I'll find some way to talk myself into buying one.
Absolutely.
Just like I bought an iPad Pro that I don't use. Shout out Apple's gross margins. I bought an Apple Pencil that I lost. Shout out Apple's gross margins. But
you are the
question.
Reason they are valued so highly.
Exactly.
Personally. Yeah.
I'm an American with a credit card and I work near technology. It's going to happen. My question is, what do we want to use these for? Because I struggle a bit, and I've in my little office pod here, I've got three different computers. I've got work Mac, personal iMac, and a gaming PC. I even got I have a gaming sim driving rig in the closet over there. I have a reasonable gaming budget and I just don't have VR yet because I just don't. So my question is, if Abrar is right that they will have the killer app, cool. But what's it going to be? That's what I can't put my finger on.
I can't either. That's the thing is, I get starry-eyed sometimes about VR. I've got the Oculus Quest 2. I bought it before they raised the price. And I used it for a while and thought, oh, yeah, this is so great. I'm going to especially do the virtual workstation where I can have a big screen here and two little ones here and have my virtual. And I just... I don't want to mess up my hair. I don't want to be sitting in this space where it's like hot and there's just this device on my face. Like, there's so many reasons why it's uncomfortable. It's unwieldy. It's awkward. It's all of these things that I don't know how they get past that. And I really like, I have to say, I feel like I have said this for years and I still believe it. I feel like all of this is just stopgap to the eventual AR future where I can hold out my hand and it is a phone screen. You know what I mean? Or just in front of me, I can have my notifications pop up, or anytime I look at a wall and there's a rectangle that's available, that can suddenly become a screen. Or we've already got HUDs in cars in some cases. And I know none of you are mobile, sorry. But it's, That is what I think we're waiting on, because that is the time where it is not this unwieldy ski goggles we're strapping to our face.
No, the ski goggles we're strapping to our face that, look, I know that Apple's will, I'm sure, be the best designed of all of them. Like you, I also got a Quest 2 right before the price went up because I was like, well, I'm not going to pay more for this old thing.
Exactly.
So that was my way of getting on it. And it's fun. I think there's some decent kind of gaming things. Like you, Alex, I also have a gaming PC and I have all the consoles and I don't play games all that much, but I have all of the gaming things. And so I'm still trying to figure out like, what is the experience that would bring me into this? And I do think that there are some gaming scenarios where I could be like, oh, if I could have like Starfield, that actually strikes me as a game that if that was able to be like a VR sort of experience, and I know it's not going to be, but that seems like the sort of thing that I could be like, okay, this could be incredible, right?
And Starfield is the new space-based RPG that's coming from the famous company that's done the stuff.
Bethesda.
Yes.
Bethesda. Oh, am I not supposed to say it? Okay. It's like,
No, you are.
No, I forgot. But okay. They made Skyrim, right?
No, they make a Fallout.
Oh, because Skyrim's terrible, but I haven't played Fallout yet. I'll give that a try. Okay.
Okay, Fallout's amazing. And so that would be like, I could see that kind of being cool. But yeah, but you're kind of look, I think that we're all sort of looking for like, okay, well, what is the experience? What is the thing that would take this to the next level? Because even something like saying like, okay, I can now have great FaceTime conversations where I can see the person I'm talking to. Okay, but am I going to see them like with their Memoji?
Right.
Am I going to see actual them? In which case, are they going to see me in my stupid goggles? There's also this whole thing of being like that. Apparently, you know, the rumors are that to get the battery thing working, it'll be a clip-on battery pack, which on the one hand, I'm like, okay, that's better than having the headset be really heavy. But on the other hand, I'm like, you're going to make me clip on a battery pack?
Haven't had to do like, that since what? The early.
Exactly. It's going to remind me of like, I was going to say, yeah, that's going to remind me of like when I used to have my Game Boy, like battery pack thing, as a kid. Or, you know, fortunately, we don't have to do this as frequently, but when everybody used to have to carry around like a battery pack for their phone, right? Like everybody would just carry like a huge, like this was like 5 years ago. Now, because we all have phablets,
there's plenty of battery built in. Yeah, exactly.
Plenty of battery built in. But like that's the sort of thing. It's like, okay, so what is the experience going to be and how is it going to be better than what we've already got? And on top of that, how is it going to be worth $3,000? Which if that is true, I'm still skeptical about that because even for Apple, that seems an absurd price point to come in at.
Yeah. And I have a larger technology budget than I probably should because I'm a little bit obsessed and still haven't, you know, my entire life. And yep. 3K is I have to go talk to my spouse and be like, I would like to waste $3,000. And then she'll give me a look like, or you could not. And I'll have to like make a case. If it was $500, I could be like, honey, by the way, I wasted $500.
Right,
and then I'll get my earlobe flicked, but it's fine.
Yeah, you know? No, $500, $1,000, even $1,500 for me, like my budget, like it's not even going to be a conversation. $3,000, I have to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And I'm thinking like $3,000 was like that's three MacBook Airs.
Right.
You know?
Crap.
Is that the unit of technology price now?
I mean that's what it should be, right? But like that's three MacBook Airs.
How many MacBook Airs was your couch back there? Sorry, I'm just
kidding. It is a really nice couch. Yeah.
It is.
Thank you so much. It's a great backdrop. Yeah.
It is actually, it's funny how the three of us on the panel have such different vibes in our backgrounds.
Mine is extra. So I hope you.
I mean, you really look put together. Like, I want to have a dinner party at your house because I know the food's going to be like on point and well put out.
I have tea parties if anyone's interested. It's like my thing.
Wait, yeah. Once we all get these Apple headsets, we can virtually have it in your house.
Yeah, I want to go. That's what I want a headset for, everyone can do tea party together. Yeah,
and that I would love, but I also want to be there in person. See,
absolutely. Let's do both.
Wait,
let's
be there in because person, plane but then tickets also headset. Are less okay. money than the headset will be. So yeah,
oh, man.
Oh no. Well, so I have to ask this.
Apple Airs.
So let's think. Then let's go back to when the Apple Watch was first announced, because I think before we knew exactly what that was going to be, and even after Apple first announced it as the most personal device you'll ever own, it was not something that we thought was going to be a thing that we needed. And now this is an incredibly popular wearable device that a lot of people use for health and fitness and notifications on their wrist. And it's almost become a proprietary eponym where, you know, it's Kleenex and you've got an Apple Watch on your wrist, even if it's a Fitbit. But what is it that makes us feel, because it does sound like we're saying that this is different from something like the Apple Watch, where it doesn't seem like it's going to fall into that boat of it makes sense for them to have and for us to have and for us to want.
Well, let me make one point about the Apple Watch, because you're right that it has become ubiquitous and it is a bona fide hit. But as I mentioned, it was originally sold as this weird fashion thing. Mm-hmm. Like that was where all the marketing and all the conversations and interviews that I did with people at Apple was really focused on the design and talking about it as like a fashion accessory. But obviously would then have, and part of that was because they didn't have a lot of apps at launch. It was kind of a glorified kind of like notification screen. It took some time for them to have the actual, watchOS SDK to really let people build interesting things that could run standalone. But they dropped the price. And they dropped the price a lot. They got rid of the, gold edition, the $16,000, watch they thought that China was going to go crazy for, but that China didn't go crazy for. And it became this thing that was I always get the stainless steel model in part because I've used my company's fitness budget as they would let me buy an Apple Watch, but then I'm like, well, that's what I'll buy. But most people get, the aluminum sport edition and you buy it every couple of years and it's great. It's just kind of it's an upgrade from a Fitbit, right? But it is sort of this thing. So the price dropped and then they focused in on the health benefits. This is the sort of thing where, for me, it's hard to see how does this become that if you're starting at $3,000.
Yeah.
Everybody's very quiet. Well, I mean, it's good, though, because we're trying to think about it, right? But go ahead, Abrar.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, I think, especially with, if we're talking about the health features on the Apple Watch, they really, really focused on giving you something with the watch that you're not going to get with your phone. Cause it's like, okay, I can count my steps on the watch. Okay. But I can also count my steps on the phone.
Right.
And then they added more health features to the watch that would, entice you to buy that so that you're adding to what you can already do. So what can they add to the headset that you can't already do on your phone? Okay. So maybe you're thinking, getting that heads up display as you're navigating or as you're walking around, is that something that you really need? Can they convince you that's something that you really need? Maybe using maps or something. I don't know. But I think, answering that question, what can I get through that that will allow me to step outside of my home, maybe even leave my phone behind? I don't know. Something along those lines just to really convince you that this is going to be worth my money.
Do you think Apple... Go ahead, Alex.
Oh, I was just going to say, if we combine the HUD idea of every rectangle being a screen and Abrar's point about, having to be something that you can kind of use day to day... what if instead of having a nerd helmet that encases your face, we had a small screen that was attached to the side of your glasses in front of your glasses?
Oh, I've been thinking about that this whole time.
And then what you could do is you could see and also get notifications. And I just want to say that Google Glass, though we all giggle at who used it and who got beaten up wearing it.
Yes.
The one time I got to wear Google Glass, I saw the translation app where it would take a sign in language and replace
that
the text with your language.
Brilliant.
One of the few times in tech when I was like, hot dang. That's really different. That is amazing.
I totally agree. I think that like there was a concept video that they made for Google Glass, which was not what the actual experience was. To go back to what you were saying earlier, Mike, about how are they going to show this off at WWDC? The concept video for Google Glass, a decade plus later, I still think is one of the most, I will never forget Google Glass being at I.O. and seeing Sergey jump out of the plane and then walk up on stage. That to this day is still like one of the most impressive keynote feeds that I don't think will ever be beaten. But that concept video, which was not what the actual experience was, where you could be like, oh, this will be this overlay of maps and this is how you can walk, or the translating, you know, the words, which was a real thing. And even the idea of like, oh, you could take photos, you know, with your eyes, really compelling. Google Glass didn't work for a lot of reasons. The earliest adopters were definitely a hindrance to that. But I think you're right. Like that is the sort of thing. That gets to Micah's point. Maybe that is the problem. Like we're all kind of waiting for that next level where we can have these things merged, you know, and kind of be a little bit like Minority Report. But do we have to have this first step first? And, yeah. and I guess the question is, because a lot of people have been trying these things with these headsets for, you know, 8 years now, I guess, going back to the first Oculus, is are we willing to wait through kind of the drudgery and like kind of the acceptance that this is the rear projection TV era before we get to like our LED and LCD, you know, flat panel TVs?
Yeah. Do you think that the biggest problem with Google Glass was that it wasn't Apple Glass?
Yeah.
Sadly, like just change the branding, have Apple sell it. I bet it would have sold, 100 times as many units?
I think it was two things. I think it was absolutely, that was one of the main issues. But I think that unfortunately, the group of people who first got their hands on Google Glass made it incredibly unfashionable. And what's the word? Gauche? Is that the word?
Their glass holes was the whole thing.
Yeah. And they really, they embodied it. So
they did. No, and I think that goes along with like if it had been an Apple versus Google, I think that Apple would have been much better about seeding that early adopter thing more.
The group.
But I do wonder though, like but you know, also I will say too, Google Glass was just a little too far ahead of its time. The vision of where it was, it wasn't able to do it. Like it could translate those words for you and it was magical, but it also took a long time. Mm-hmm. You need it to be instantaneous for that sort of thing to really work. Which is ironically sort of what we're seeing with generative AI now. Whereas when you look at AI assistants from, you know, a decade ago, it promised us this stuff, but it wasn't there. Now we can add, I think the reason why people get so excited about ChatGPT, even when it hallucinates, even when it's wrong, is that you can ask these questions and it will tell you the name of the TV show and the episode that you were talking about. And it will give you this information like immediately, and it's not taking forever. It's giving it to you instantly. And that's what we need for these things, I think, to work.
I agree, absolutely. And the fact that it, because this is what I think is going to be so magnificent about what Microsoft is doing with Office, when you can let that assistant, because, so it's multiple points here. One, I don't have to speak to it in its specific syntax and diction. I can say what I want, and it is already using that large language model processing to figure out what I'm actually asking. And then what it can do from there is go out to different aspects of, in the case of Office, these different tools and pull all of that together. So when I say, take this presentation and turn it into a document for a summary, I didn't have to say, hey, boo-boo, please do this and this and this. And then I have to wait for it to do that. And then I have to ask the next thing and then the next thing and the next thing. It just can take all of what I'm saying and then it properly translates it into the language of the computer system and then goes out to those three or four different aspects. And the fact that it can do all of that together because it has the ability to translate what we as humans are actually asking into something that the computer can understand, I think that's what makes it next level. I do want to ask though too, because I do think that you know, the AR thing is a more long term. We've heard that this could be a mixed reality headset, but a lot of times with VR, the supposedly compelling and killer apps are games. Does Apple's lack of chops in gaming, is that going to be harmful to the company's ability to push a product that very likely is going to be heavily focused, at least in its first iterations, on that gaming ecosystem. And then furthermore, given what we've seen about Apple inviting special press members to the game to talk about the gaming stuff that they're doing, and them talking a lot about gaming on macOS, and I think there was a game that launched on macOS not too terribly long ago, Resident Evil or something like that, I don't recall, is this going to be trouble for Apple to be able to say, hey, we've got a device and you can game on it and you want to game with us as opposed to Microsoft's Xbox or the PlayStation?
So, Christina, you don't game much. Abrar, do you game?
No.
I game a smaller proportion of what I spend on gaming.
Okay. No, I have an Xbox sitting on my desk over there that I've used twice.
Oh, so none of us are gamers.
No, I'm a PC gamer.
Oh, so you do PC game, though.
I'm an actual gamer. I'm not
a one of the... Get him off. Get him off of here. Bye.
This is one of my longest... Okay. Calm down. It's a really good point about Apple and gaming because I love my Macs. I do. They're great. But if I ever want to play anything that's interactive, I fire up the PC. I fire up Steam. It is easier. It is faster. Things are better rendered. They're more optimized. And frankly, I'm trying to think of a single game I've seen on iOS App Store that I've looked at on iPads and iPhones for years that I would be excited about playing in a VR context. And the answer is none. I think.
Yeah.
So given that, either they're going to have no games that make it exciting and therefore it's kind of kaput out the gate, or they're working with major game developers already on this. But I feel like we've heard nothing about that. Like,
and
not
a think
peep.
We would.
So... Apple can't keep its secrets anymore because it's too big.
It almost is a detriment to the company. I think that Minecraft is owned by a certain big company because I think that's a killer AR experience.
Oh, being able you're to dead Minecraft. On. It's so funny. I had the same conversation with somebody the other day where I said exactly that, where I was like, Minecraft, it was actually in my work Slack. I was like, Minecraft, ironically, would be like the perfect killer thing for this. And I know they tried to show that off in one of the early HoloLens demos, which was amazing, but like you're like, okay, but now you can actually bring it there. And not that I think that, you know, I think that they would be very happy to have Minecraft on stage instead of Roblox, showing that off, right? But those are the two things where you think about, you're like, okay, but Minecraft really would be like a perfect, like,
I would love to build, like, just to turn my living room, to turn Abrar's sofa into a Minecraft mine, dig down inside and find like gold, or I don't even know how Minecraft works, to be honest, but it would be so fun.
But Christina's point about the early HoloLens stuff is dead on, because that was the demo that really made me feel amazing. I pushed a block off a thing and it like went through a hole in a table, but the table was real there, but I couldn't see the table because I was wearing HoloLens, and it was like, it did feel like a step forward, turned out to nowhere, but maybe someone will get it right down the road. And if someone is going to get it right late, a bit like smartphones and the iPhone, perhaps it's going to be Apple. So I'm like skeptical, but always willing to give them benefit of the doubt because I've been wrong in the past. So I don't want to say no. I'm going to say, probably not, but.
Yeah, that's how I feel. I'm like, I will never bet against Apple, but I'm also, I'm skeptical about some of the rumors about the price and some of those things, because I'm like, that just doesn't feel right at all. And I try to remind myself, remember how much they said the iPad was going to cost, and the iPad was only $500.
That's true.
So maybe they'll be wrong on that, but you do wonder, you're like, you need that killer app. And to Rare's point, like, I think that for the Apple Watch, it really was like the health stuff, like heart rate, like when you could start doing the heart monitoring and starting like the fall detection and things like that, that's when it went from being like, okay, well, this is a glorified Fitbit, to, well, this is also this thing I can get my parents, or, you know, somebody else, you know, might be useful for. I mean, like the Apple Watch, I had some sort of weird heart thing where my heart rate was like, I was just standing, it was like 140, and for just resting heart rate. And it notified me of that, right? Mm-hmm. Like, but there have been other AFib situations. I wasn't an AFib, fortunately, where that's a real killer feature. And so I don't know what the corollary there is in this world, but if anybody can get it, it's probably them.
Yeah.
But the watch, though, like, sits for me, like, very much on top of my iPhone and how I think about their usefulness.
Totally.
you know? And yes. So I'm very curious, does the AR VR thing from Apple, does it sit on top of my Mac or is it independent or what does it kind of lean on for leverage to get a toehold into the market if it's not existing applications or an obvious easy price point? You're running low on options
there.
That's
a good point. No, that's a good point. I mean, it would be interesting if they had it sit on top of the Mac, because in that case, I'd be like, well, okay, maybe instead of buying two Apple, you know, studio displays, I just buy one of these things. And then I have, you know, like all the screens. That would be a way for me to talk myself into buying one. I'm not going to lie. But it probably will be building off of the iPhone, which is, you know, has had ARKit for a long time and that they will, you know, be building those experiences on. But then, yeah, you have to wonder, but can this operate independently?
Do you use
AR kit?
Question.
Does anyone here use AR on their iPhone?
So the thing is, many of us who are using our iPhones for cameras are using AR kit, whether we know it or not, because there's some of the camera functionality that makes use of some of the tools in ARKit to do proper focusing and proper depth of field effects if you're using it. I don't really use the portrait effects very often. But in terms of sort of apps that make use of AR, I can't remember the last time I did it outside of just purposely doing a gimmick where I was kind of like, I designed...
The measurement app.
Yeah, the measurement app. That's a good one. That's actually a good recommendation for people to get a chance to see ARKit in action in a way that's somewhat beneficial, because you can measure like a whole wall using AR, which is kind of nice.
It's actually very useful.
Yeah. And what about any other uses for that? Is anyone playing any games with AR? No.
I don't commute.
No.
Why would I need an iPhone game?
Okay, fair enough. I do want to talk about something that is... okay, so Apple just recently announced a new service called Apple Pay Later. And this is a way for people to make a purchase that is split up over payments. And so it, in some cases can be allowed to, or can help you make a bigger purchase. So you know, $300 split into four payments, no fees, no interest. And many people, I think, are familiar with the different services that are out there that offer similar features. So you can, there's some where they do charge a fee, but they spread it out over a longer period of time. There are some that work just like this. There are some that are built into kind of like those payment apps that already exist. And then some companies, I've actually made use of Amazon. I don't know if they still do this because I haven't seen it in a long time. But when I first moved here and bought some furniture for my living room, I actually made use of Amazon's payment system where it split up the sofa that is not as cool as a Braz into four payments. And I was able to get that furniture. But I want to talk first about the service in general, but then I want to get into a little bit of a discussion about where people are in terms of the responsibility of this technology. Because what I find interesting about this is how different people from different financial backgrounds in particular have different thoughts about this. So first and foremost, if it's something that you care to share, have you ever made use of a sort of buy now, pay later system, and, you know, has it been beneficial to you? And then if you have used Apple Pay, are you looking forward to Apple adding this functionality? And it's up to you who wants to start. We'll go with Abrar. Okay.
Okay. Amazing. I have not used a buy now, pay later system before. I think one of the things that some financial experts have been cautioning with this and with other systems is just not putting too much on your plate, right? So making sure that it's great that these platforms exist, and I think there are lots of good uses for them. But I think, you know, one of the points is to just remember that, you know, just to keep in mind your financial limits and you know, maybe not necessarily be enticed by how convenient this may seem, but I do think that this is a really great convenient feature to just be baked into Apple Pay. Cause I use Apple Pay as if it's Apple paying for my stuff. Like it's just like
Apple
everywhere.
Pay. Yeah. I like that.
Yeah. So I think it's super interesting to see this kind of stuff just become a lot more seamless and built into our devices. But, But yeah, I think just I'm always overly cautious about these things. And I just try to hold myself back if it's not something that I think is right for me to be purchasing at a specific point in time.
Nice. Oh. Alex?
So I'm kind of similar. I haven't used any BNPL services that I'm aware of. I see them online wherever I go. They're like, do you want to split your sandwich into four payments?
Right. Yep.
And I have to admit that I don't, because that's ridiculous. I also don't really use Apple Pay. We just have one credit card. We just have an auto pay just to get miles for Southwest. So I just use that. I feel kind of like a Luddite now, because I feel like I should be using Apple Pay more often. But to me, Apple's move into fintech in general seems like a search for growth and a bit of a strange place for the company to be in. So I'm a little bit skeptical of it. I didn't like the Apple Card, the Goldman Sachs partnership, because it didn't seem to be at all useful unless you bought tons of Apple products, which seemed to be just self-serving in a way that was kind of gross. So to me, when they announced this, the reason why I cared about the BNPL announcement from Apple was that the stocks of public BNPL companies got whacked, because everyone was thinking that Apple was going to come in like a 10-ton gorilla or whatever the phrase is and smash everybody. And then it just didn't come out until, you know, now we're talking about it again. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the moment since then has passed, like the days when Klarna was worth like $60 billion and Square bought Afterpay for like $25 billion and all of this. The valuation of fintech companies has gone down by like an enormous factor, because this stuff isn't as valuable as a business as people hoped it was. Mm-hmm. So Apple doing this feels a little bit late. It feels a little bit modest. And frankly, I don't think I care.
Very well. Christina?
Yeah, so it's weird, because I do feel like, exactly like Alex said, I think he's dead on that the moment when Klarna and Afterpay and Affirm and all these companies were these massive valuations, that's over. And part of that is strictly like financial stuff, right? Like in an era when interest rates were zero, then that those services made complete sense, because you could take on some of the risk, even if you know that a certain portion of people are going to, you know, wind up not paying. You can take on some of that, and you can have lower or even zero interest in some of those cases, you know, offers. But interest rates are not zero anymore, and so lending has become a lot more stringent. So the timing does feel off, but it also feels like maybe they have to launch it just because it's done finally, and they have obligations to their friends at Goldman Sachs or whoever they partnered with on this to do it or not. I tend to not use buy now, pay later services. I have a few times if it was literally 0% interest and they were like, for 6 months, you can do this. And I'm like, well, if you're not going to charge me, I can make more money having my money in other places than paying it all at once. Right. So I'm not opposed to that. But in general, I don't like them. I find them predatory, if I'm being completely honest. There's very much of a payday loan type of smell with this stuff. I don't like it when Microsoft, my former employer, is putting these things into Microsoft Edge. I don't like it when Apple is getting into this area. It feels gross. That said, you know, if people can genuinely find benefit out of it, and if people who might have otherwise difficult time getting access to credit and some other things, maybe. But in general, I'm not a huge fan of these services. And I tend to think that they can get people in a lot of trouble really quickly, because people don't understand how compound interest works and understand what the terms that they're necessarily signing up for are. And
I think the way that you have put that is you put it very well. I think with the 0% interest and with the no fees, and as long as that remains true, I feel a little bit better about those systems, because I come from a pretty poor growing up family, and even to this day, a lot of financial struggles in my family. And so I have seen for a few family members who were in situations where, they had someone pass away or something like that, and they needed to go to a funeral that was in, you know, a few states over. They didn't have the money on hand to be able to afford the plane ticket. And so being able to use one of these kinds of services was the difference between being able to go there or not. And because it was zero interest and yada, 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 then it was something that was doable for them, where they were basically just paying back the plane ticket over time, where they could afford that more. And in those specific instances, or like when I first moved here and was adjusting to California rent versus Missouri rent and everything that was involved with that, and like having to just spend money to move halfway across the country. It was beneficial to me as a 0% interest and no fees situation to be able to sort of spread that out. And so I'm always mindful of that in the back of my head, in the same place where I've got the other side that's going, also don't let this become predatory, because I don't ever want it to be this sort of elitist perspective. Because there are some times where it almost feels like when someone gets upset that like a person who doesn't make very much money, who maybe needs financial help from the government, so food stamps, for example, or EBT, I guess they call it. They have EBT, and then you learn, oh, but you like pay a monthly subscription for Netflix. If you are on EBT, then you shouldn't have Netflix. Like, you know, I don't ever want it to feel like that sort of elitist, a person who doesn't make enough money can't ever have anything that is a comfort item, or can't, you know, make them happy, or something that they need. It is, as long as it remains in that place, then I think that it is a benefit overall, especially as things keep getting more and more expensive. But as everyone's saying here, I think the word that everybody's using, that the term, is when it becomes predatory. And, you know, I have seen a family member who went down the route. I mean, there was, I didn't even know this existed, but they had found an app that was practically, like you were saying, Christina, a payday loan app, and it had just ridiculous interest rates, but they weren't thinking about that when they did it, and it, you know, ended up costing them so much money. So when it's that, that is very, 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 very bad. As a means of maybe democratizing access in a non-predatory way, that is where I feel like I'm trying to be more open-minded to it. So yeah, I don't know. I'm keeping an eye on things though, because I don't know what it looks like if a person doesn't end up paying for 1 month. Does interest then kick in and fees kick in? Is it only fee free and interest free as long as you're making the payments? I mean, those different services all have different terms. So yeah, something to keep an eye on. Go ahead, Alex.
I think all that was incredibly well put. And when I said that I don't care about it, I was more trying to reference the passing moment versus it not being an important part of the conversation. So I just want to clear up that I was being dismissive of the timing versus the conversation that we're having about keeping things on the up and up. But to put it in perspective about how much time has passed since this was, I think, kind of on the ascent or on the come up, if you will, I bought a Peloton during the pandemic because apparently that's how life goes. And I paid for it when I bought it. And everyone kind of was made fun of me on Twitter for this. They're like, oh, you should have just put it on a firm, because then you could get 0% interest for X number of months. And I was just like, I don't want to have an Affirm account. I don't want to deal with that. I just would like, I wanted to buy a Peloton. So I did. And it was weird. Everyone was almost like money shaming me about how I didn't collect no interest on that money.
Weird.
What's so funny is the whole reason I have an Affirm account, which I didn't use, is I was going to get my parents a Peloton. And I signed up just to see, well, would they cover it? And they were like, yeah, we'll cover the whole thing interest free. And then my mom told me under no expression. She was like, we do not want a Peloton.
Please don't send that to our house. Please.
She was like, we do not want a Peloton. She was like, I have to have a certain type of bike for my knees, and the Peloton is not that type of bike. And so do not buy us a Peloton. So I was like, all right, well, I'm not getting a Peloton. I don't have room for Peloton and I won't use it. So I have an Affirm account that I've never used anything on, but I do still get their emails, you know, from that. So that's funny.
That is interesting. But
I will say that the era in which Affirm was growing before it went public, when Peloton was blowing up and they were the hottest thing in the world, that now feels like 74 years ago.
It really does. It really does. And it was, right? Because it was pre-pandemic. It was, you know, and then pandemic a little bit too, but the interest rates were zero and you know, money was just free flying. And that is not the case anymore. And so, yeah, to your point, like, I don't know what the rules are if you don't make a payment. I mean, I think usually the principal is due, but I don't know if interest starts or what the circumstances are. And I don't know the size of the loans, but I do become concerned because I want these options to be available to people because like you were saying, Micah, like if it's the difference between someone being able to go to a funeral or not, then that should exist. And I definitely don't want to shame anybody for, I don't care what your circumstances are. You still deserve to have Netflix or anything else. But I do worry, it's like these things can become incredibly predatory, and the way that they make it look you know, we see it the same way that you see with in-app purchase stuff where they show you like the, oh, it's only going to cost this much a week. And you don't see the week part. And
maybe yeah, your mind it's like dark patterns.
It's totally dark patterns. And so I become really concerned with this. And I become concerned with this from any company that is looking at this as a revenue stream and as a growth engine. And I, you know, I expressed those concerns to, you know, the integration with Microsoft Edge when I was at Microsoft. And I feel the same way about this stuff at Apple. I'm not in general a big fan, but I also do appreciate why these systems exist, because not everyone wants a credit card or can have a credit card or you know, whatever their circumstances are.
Yeah.
Yes. But if you are annoyed at the cost of Apple's AR VR doohickey costing $3,000, man, Apple has a brand new BNPL system. One plus one equals three.
Oh my God. No, you're exactly right though, because I do use, that's the one thing I use my Apple card for, is primarily just for Apple purchases, because I can get like the interest free. And in my mind, I'm like, well, yeah, I could pay for this immediately, but why not put it over 24 months? Why not?
Yeah. Now the money has an actual value to it. Put that in your money market account at 4% and you'll make 73 cents. Good job.
That 73 cents I can spend on a gumball.
Maybe.
Yeah, exactly. Who knows? All right. Let's take a quick break before we come back with loads more. I've got a great panel today. Abrar Alhiti from CNET. I've got Alex Wilhelm from TechCrunch and Christina Warren, a.k.a. Film Girl, senior developer advocate at GitHub. This Week in Tech is brought to you by ExpressVPN, which is genuinely the VPN I use and have used for years. You probably already know about ExpressVPN because we've talked a lot about it on this show, and because many of you are probably have used it or are using it, and that's because it's so great. It's so important that you are protecting yourself online, and there are a number of ways to do so. But I think sometimes we might forget about the ways we need to protect ourselves in terms of our browsing online and the protection that we need to have from our ISPs, in some cases, your internet service provider, and even, you know, companies like big tech companies. But, you know, there are other reasons why you and I like using ExpressVPN. And that's whenever we're streaming content, like content from Netflix, because there are thousands of shows on Netflix that are only available outside of the US. So you can use a VPN to change your country if you'd like to access them. You are appearing from somewhere else. You're traveling without having to travel. ExpressVPN lets you do that. What the ExpressVPN app does is it essentially encrypts your data and reroutes it through a server location in your place of choice. Not only is this going to be protecting the browsing that you're doing online, but it also lets you control which country you want a service like Netflix to think you're in. ExpressVPN lets you choose from more than 90 countries. So every time you run out of stuff to watch, just fire up the app on your laptop, your smart TV, switch your country, and hit connect. Once you refresh the page, you'll get a brand new selection of shows. It's that simple. And this is honestly the best part. And I will be honest, it's one of the means of my enjoyment online is it's not just for Netflix. You can use ExpressVPN to unlock shows or sports on other streaming services too. One example is that there is an Australian-based streaming service called 10play. And 10play has the most incredible reality TV show on it called Australian Survivor. Yes, there's American Survivor, but forget about American Survivor. Australian Survivor is 1,000 times better. Unfortunately, it used to be that you could watch it in the United States via, I don't remember what service, but at one point it was there. And then I kid you not, on February 14th, on Valentine's Day at 5 p.m., their license to, I'm going to get mad, their license to stream it ran out. And instead of letting me literally finish the finale episode of the show, they just stopped letting me watch it 3/4 of the way through the episode. So I fired up ExpressVPN. I hopped on over to 10play And suddenly I was able to finish the episode and continue the wonderful experience that is Australian Survivor. I'm not kidding. If any of you like Survivor, you've got to see Australian Survivor. It's so much better. ExpressVPN is rated number one by CNET. You may have heard of them. Wired, Tech Radar, and countless other services. And you know what? It's rated number one by me. I use ExpressVPN on all of my devices. And as much as, you know, they are a sponsor of the network, but the thing that I feel sets ExpressVPN apart is sometimes people will tell you they went through the privacy policies, they went through the terms of service, and maybe they skimmed it. No, I wanted to be sure that what I once believed about ExpressVPN to be true was still true. And so I did so much research making sure that, you know, because ExpressVPN was acquired by a company and there was some like, oh, you know, what's going on? I looked through privacy policies. I read independent reports. In fact, one of the cool things about ExpressVPN, there was one period of time where there was a government who went and tried to seize ExpressVPN's assets and their servers and everything. But because ExpressVPN runs all of these servers on flash memory instead of running it on hard drives, then it's volatile memory. So that means that whenever it powers off, all that stuff is gone. And that is how they do it. They make sure that after it's done, after, you know, it's time to sort of refresh, everything goes away. So the government tried to seize their assets and they're like, we don't have anything for you. I mean, you can come in and look. There wasn't anything for them to have. So they're not collecting. They're not logging. They're not doing that. And when ExpressVPN says that, they actually do mean it. And it holds up because despite just independent auditors who have confirmed it, I think the best way to find out if a company is truly not logging your data is to have the government of a country suddenly come knocking when they weren't planning on it. And then they look and they can't get anything either. So if you're looking for a VPN to trust, look no further. ExpressVPN.com/twit. Head there right now and get 3 extra months free of their service. That's ExpressVPN.com/twit. T-W-I-T, expressvpn.com/twit to learn more and sign up. Thank you, ExpressVPN, for sponsoring this week's episode of This Week in Tech. All right, back from the break, and now it is time to move along home. Let's talk about E3. So, I know,
R.I.P.
It's sad. E3's canceled. Why? What's going on?
All right, better question. E3 is canceled. Sad. And somehow CES is still not.
Yeah. Right.
What's up with that?
Well, one of them is way better at selling booths than the other.
Oh, so you think this is like a marketing sort of business development issue rather than just the big companies not wanting to participate?
Well, that's the same thing.
Fair enough. Yeah, that's true.
Right. Like, because CES has seen the same thing where like a lot of the big companies have pulled out. Right. Like Microsoft used to always have a big booth there, and Intel and some of the other things have their evening keynotes, and you still have some of that, but most of the biggest tech companies don't have the big keynotes they used to, but they were been able to effectively. Then they went to car companies because car tech is a big part of it. And so they were able to get all the car manufacturers there, turn it into a car show. They're able to go to a lot of the Chinese manufacturers in other parts of Asia and bring them in. So I think they were still able to sell booth sales. Whereas E3, if you don't have Microsoft, you don't have Sony, you don't have Nintendo, there's very little reason for a lot of the studios and publishers to show up, especially when you also have the fan conferences that have been incredibly successful where they can get more hands-on, do more of that level of marketing push than what they used to get from E3.
That strikes me as correct, but also, you know, when they think about game distribution and where you get your gaming information, I mean, Steam recently had an event called City Builder Fest or something like that. And I love city building video games. And I was like, oh my gosh, there's literally a tailored event just for me.
Exactly.
And they worked with indie developers to put out demos, early access for certain games. And even some really small devs got to partake in this thing that at E3, they would have been absolutely marginalized.
Exactly.
Because it was tailored and online, it was possible. Another example, Paradox, which makes Crusader Kings and EU and all those kind of grand strategy games, they just have Paradox Con or something like that. It's their own thing. They don't need to come to E3. It's a bit like how the Grammys don't matter anymore. Sorry.
Kind of, yeah. No, it was, no, you're dead on. But then you have things like PAX, right, which can be more generalist, and you have things like TwitchCon, which frankly is a little bit like E3 in some senses, because you will have publishers there and you have the personalities who are behind the stuff that people want to do. So, I think it started with the big tech companies. You know, Apple's never done CES, but you know, they would have their own direct events. And but when they left Macworld, right, they used to have their keynotes part of Macworld. And when Apple was like, we're not going to be part of Macworld anymore, we're just going to go direct. And then, you know, the Nintendo Direct is a thing, and Sony and Microsoft, you know, Xbox have their things. There's not a reason to have everybody at this one industry conference, especially if you can have the either online or in person indie ones like you're talking about around a certain genre, or you know, people find other ways to get their information. It's sad, but I'm also, it's kind of one of those things. I'm like, well, this has been coming for a really long time.
And what do we think is sort of the, is it that there are fewer people going? Is it that you get more control if you do it yourself? Is it that it costs less money if you, I mean, I'm sure it's an amalgamation, but what sort of started the trend of just getting companies, do we think, of just getting companies to sort of go, we'll just do the, I don't need you, E3.
Yeah, I think it was the control aspect. I think it went from like, okay, why do I have to deal with this third party to have to talk about what is my time slot, and what is, you know, how big is my, you know, booth or other areas going to be, or what can I show or what can I not, and who can I allow here? I have to think that they just kind of realized, well, we have, you know, trust that we have the direct to audience experience. I think social media was honestly also changed it too, right? Because it was one thing when I was growing up in the 90s and reading about E3 and like dreaming of going, you would read about it like in the magazines, like a month after it happened. And then, you know, you had websites like IGN and some others that started up, and they would maybe give you information like the next day or the following week. But now it's at the point, you know, where you can literally watch the presentations, even when it was happening at E3, you could watch it as it happened. It's happening on Twitter. It's happening on other forms of social media. So you no longer have that weight. And so at that point, I think the companies realized, oh, we actually have these audiences that are just tuned into us. We don't have to have the benefit of the trade organization and then the press that would all come to that thing to write about it. Like, we can literally just go directly to our gamers. And so I think that's a social media thing.
Democratization, right? I used to hide copies of PC Gamer in my bedroom because I was banned from playing video games as a kid because my parents were more conservatively religious, perhaps, than I've ended up. And I would read about Doom 3 and these games that I couldn't wait to play later on when I was, you know, on my own. And I cared about their view because they were the industry source. Now, what do I care about? Not reviews, really. I just go to Steam and look at the recent review rating. Is it overwhelmingly positive? Is it very positive? Is it mixed? And frankly, I know I can go read those reviews, figure out if they apply to me or not. And very quickly, I don't need the gatekeepers. And this is why the Grammys, the Emmys, the blah, 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 and the other doohickeys and the award stuff that people will still pretend to care about are losing their relevance, because they just don't have the grip on the culture that they used to. And this is why I think Taylor Swift can put out her own music and have it go to number one around the world overnight. She doesn't need a gatekeeper. And E3, CES, and et cetera are essentially byproducts of a bygone, more centralized information era. The internet killed them slowly.
Wow.
So, Alex, I absolutely love that you've mentioned Taylor Swift twice.
I was going to say.
Me too. Yes. Me too. I was like, hell yeah.
This is a panel. I don't quite include myself in that, so I'm just going to like pull back. This is the Swiftie panel, and I'm realizing now I put together the Swiftie panel, and I didn't realize that's what happened.
I'm so proud.
I'm so proud of all of us.
I've been on with Christina before a couple of times, and I've just known Christina for a long time. But Abrar, I went to your Twitter profile before, and I saw that you had Taylor Swift mentioned there, and I was like, excellent, because I think Anti-Hero Acoustic Version is a high piece of modern art.
Yes.
And my baby loves it because often she won't sleep. And so what she gets is that on repeat with me trying to harmonize. So it's been a smash hit at our house.
Aw.
I love that. I'm so happy to be on this panel with you guys. Good choice, Micah. You should be great.
I have to say, oh my God. John in our studio just held up a sign that said, they're the problem.
Yes. Oh, hi, John.
That was very good. Very culturally mindful. I did have a question, though. It used to be that, because, you know, I've gone to CES like 3 times over, the past, a lot of years. And I forgot that I am also getting older. Anyway, and in going to CES those times, hate it. Obviously don't have any interest in going, but one of the things that you hear whenever people talk about going to that or going to any of these sort of big in-person events is like, yeah, you know, it doesn't seem super useful except for the opportunity to socialize, except for the opportunity to get together with people in the industry you haven't seen before. Are we getting to a place where that doesn't even matter anymore?
Well, again, though, I think it depends because it's an industry conference. So there are other ones that are, you know, you have things like GDC, which are more focused, you know, on the game developers. And you have some other more focused conferences that are around that. For things like CES, you know, there might be other, you know, industry symposiums people could go to kind of meet up with one another. But for many, many years, you know, like the normal person going to the trade show aspect has been gone. Like I remember with E3, because it was in Atlanta in the 90s, a number of times. I remember like taking like a business card from like the local electronics boutique and like passing it off me. Like, even though I'm not old enough to work at EB Games, like I have a business card and this is me, and let me have access to go, you know, through mm-hmm. through the trade show floor and see all the stuff. But that's most of the best stuff is not even on the floor now. So again, it's those things like PAX and you know, BlizzCon and things like that, that I think have more of the social aspect where people want to meet up and do that. Like, I think that it's weird. I almost feel like there is still that aspect, but those things have happened with maybe smaller or more focused conferences rather than like the big Omni conference. I do feel like for some companies, the reason they go to CES, to your point, is probably we know that there will be a ton of manufacturers and a ton of partners and a ton of potentially money people that we can get time with. But they're doing those meetings while they're in Las Vegas. It's not necessarily like happening on the floor of CES.
Yeah. So I ran into the CEO of Microsoft in the bowels of some Vegas hotel at one CES after I was told that he was not going. And what they meant by that was he's not going to talk to you. What he was going to do, and this is, to be clear, I'm not annoyed. He was going there to talk to partners, vendors who were all in town and, you know, reasonable enough, but that's behind closed doors out of the public eye. And that does not make the actual event any more particularly relevant to us. And I just one more thing. I think as the gaming companies have become increasingly blobs, you might say, like one or two major blobs, I think that they just don't want to share. Whereas in the old days, if there's 15 leading companies, then you might all want to get together, collect viewership, and try to outshine. But if there's only 3 companies, you're going to end up with them all going their own way. So Microsoft shouldn't be allowed to buy Activision. That's what I'm saying.
Oh, wow. There it is. Really, really want to make our favorite Marine angry, don't you?
I'm sorry. It's anti-competitive. Like, of course it is. Of course Adobe buying Figma is anti-competitive. Businesses don't buy stuff to increase competition.
So all acquisitions are anti-competitive is what you're saying.
I'm not going to go that far, but I think the ones that we're discussing, let's see. Microsoft owns a gaming platform that it wants to compete against PlayStation with. What do they use to compete? Gaming exclusives. And sure, they're going to pledge 10 years of playing nice. Great. I'll be 43 then when they stop doing that. Companies like to win.
Capitalism,
I just don't believe they're going to suddenly put on kid gloves and become all hunky-dory.
Well, I don't know if anyone on the
Sorry, I didn't mean to go. That's a thing.
Sorry. I think now is actually a good time to take a quick break for a message from Leo.
Hey, everybody. Leo Laporte here. I am the founder and one of the hosts at the TWiT Podcast Network. I want to talk to you a little bit about what we do here at TWiT, because I think it's unique. And I think for anybody who is bringing a product or a service to a tech audience, you need to know about what we do here at TWiT. We've built an amazing audience of engaged, intelligent, affluent listeners who listen to us and trust us when we recommend a product. Our mission statement is to build a highly engaged community of tech enthusiasts. Boy, already you should be, your ears should be perking up at that, because highly engaged is good for you. Tech enthusiasts, if that's who you're looking for, this is the place. We do it by offering them the knowledge they need to understand and use technology in today's world. And I hear from our audience all the time, part of that knowledge comes from our advertisers. We are very careful. We pick advertisers with great products, great services, with integrity, and introduce them to our audience with authenticity and genuine enthusiasm. And that makes our Host Red ads different from anything else you can buy. We are literally bringing you to the attention of our audience and giving you a big, fat endorsement. We like to create partnerships with trusted brands, brands who are in it for the long run, long-term partners that want to grow with us. And we have so many great success stories. Tim Broom, who founded IT Pro TV in 2013, started advertising with us on day one, has been with us ever since. He said, quote, "We would not be where we are today without the TWiT network." I think the proof is in the pudding. Advertisers like IT Pro TV and Audible that have been with us for more than 10 years, they stick around because their ads work. And honestly, isn't that why you're buying advertising? You get a lot with TWiT. We have a very full service attitude. We almost think of it as kind of artisanal advertising, boutique advertising. You'll get a full service continuity team. People who are on the phone with you, who are in touch with you, who support you from with everything from copywriting to graphic design. So you are not alone in this. We embed our ads into the shows. They're not added later. They're part of the shows. In fact, often they're such a part of our shows that our other hosts will chime in on the ad saying, "Yeah, I love that." Or just the other day, one of our hosts said, "Man, I really got to buy that." That's an additional benefit to you because you're hearing people our audience trusts saying, "Yeah, that sounds great." We deliver, always over deliver on impressions. So you know you're going to get the impressions you expect. The ads are unique every time. We don't pre-record them and roll them in. We are genuinely doing those ads in the middle of the show. We'll give you great onboarding services. Ad tech with PodSites, that's free for direct clients, gives you a lot of reporting, gives you a great idea of how well your ads are working. You'll get courtesy commercials. You actually can take our ads and share them across social media and landing pages. That really extends the reach. There are other free goodies too, including mentions in our weekly newsletter that's sent to thousands of fans, engaged fans who really want to see this stuff. We give you bonus ads and social media promotion too. So if you want to be a long-term partner, introduce your product to a savvy, engaged tech audience. Visit twit.tv/advertise. Check out those testimonials. Mark McCrary was the CEO of Authentic. You probably know him, one of the biggest original podcast advertising companies. We've been with him for 16 years. Mark said the feedback from many advertisers over 16 years across a range of product categories, everything from razors to computers, is that if ads and podcasts are going to work for a brand, they're going to work on TWiT shows. I'm very proud of what we do because it's honest, it's got integrity, it's authentic, and it really is a great introduction to our audience of your brand. Our listeners are smart, they're engaged, they're tech savvy, they're dedicated to our network, and that's one of the reasons we only work with high integrity partners that we've personally and thoroughly vetted. I have absolute approval on everybody. If you've got a great product, I want to hear from you. Elevate your brand by reaching out today at advertise@twit.tv. Break out of the advertising norm. Grow your brand with Host Red ads on twit.tv. Visit twit.tv/advertise for more details, or you can email us advertise@twit.tv if you're ready to launch your campaign now. I can't wait to see your product. So give us a ring.
All right. Thanks, Leo, for that short little message. We are back and we have a great panel. Christina Warren, Senior Developer Advocate at GitHub, Alex Wilhelm of TechCrunch, and Abrar Alhiti
of CNET, video host and producer, all here with us. And I'm just scrolling through my list here. I did want to talk about something. And Christina, I don't know, you know, if you feel like this is something that you aren't able to discuss, or you are, of course, I totally understand, because this is about Security Copilot. Microsoft is working on sort of a GPT-4 powered assistant for cybersecurity. And I thought this was cool, given Microsoft seems to be, in the same way, I think, of course, first and foremost of Apple, because I cover that company more than any other in a given week. And one of the things that I've seen Apple do, and Amazon has done this in a big way too, is sort of brand their artificial intelligence stuff, right? And so Siri is not just the virtual assistant at Apple. It is also the sort of AI mind that is paying attention to your behavior and then serving up different suggestions. They call those Siri suggestions. And we've seen now Microsoft, where at one point I think Cortana was seeming to be the big sort of overall umbrella brand for all of the different kinds of AI active suggestions it was making. Now it seems like Copilot is the brand. And so we've seen Copilot in GitHub. We've seen Copilot making its way into Office. And now there's a Security Copilot. And this is specifically for security professionals. And I think, once again, this is kind of a fascinating concept, this idea that you will have a little angel sitting on your shoulder that is helping you as you're moving along and you are working on things, to provide some assistance, to provide even because of the fact that this virtual assistant or this virtual experience can kind of look at all aspects of your security posture and be able to look at all of those signals and pull that together and say, hey, it's looking like someone's trying to breach your system. Here's what you need to know about this. Once again, Alex, this is that augmentation of a human's ability that I think is a potentially very valuable tool, where the human ultimately has to make the choice of how to approach the issue, but to be able to have something that can take all of that data and sort of put it down into something that makes sense and look at potential trends for that data, I think is a really cool idea. And I like, Christina, that Microsoft does seem to be going, we have this partnership in place, and we have the technology, and then they're going, where all can we stick it? It's kind of a spaghetti project, but it seems to be working in a very positive way so far.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean, and definitely does seem to be like, I think that is like the brand that we're going for a lot of things is definitely Copilot. And you know, I work at GitHub. We were the ones who that was, you know, kind of how that was chosen. But the Microsoft has started to use it, Microsoft 365 Copilot and Security Copilot and Dynamics Copilot, and so X Copilot, which is great. And it follows the Microsoft tradition of taking a common word, like Word, and turning it into, you know, a product name. So I do like that. But I think that this is the sort of area where when you have something that could be really complicated to explain things like security topics or to synthesize a lot of different information, I think this could be a really good use of AI. The one thing I would say is that as with anything else, you know, don't become just reliant on this particular thing. Mm-hmm. You know, like I would never say to anybody, make this be the only thing you rely on for your security stuff. But I do feel like this could be a good way of helping synthesize a lot of information and point things out that people might otherwise miss.
Yeah, I think the branding points is very good, because Microsoft has taken common words and turned them into brand names. It's also taken people's names and used them quite extensively as well. For example, the last CEO of Microsoft, big Friends fan, Chandler Bing search. Well-known fact. And by the way, I'm kidding, just to be clear. I think the branding point is actually good here, because if you go back in time to Microsoft consumer products, remember SkyDrive?
Yeah.
Before it was OneDrive because of a copyright issue?
Before it was LiveDrive.
Oh, LiveDrive didn't last. That was terrible.
It was SkyDrive, LiveDrive, OneDrive. Yeah.
Yeah, and then everyone forgot because OneDrive was bleh. But I thought the Cortana name was super hype because it was a cool use of IP from the gaming world and bringing it into a consumer productivity perspective. However, Copilot, to the point about it being AI helping you as your buddy, actually, which is what Cortana was doing, but no one knew that in the video game franchise world. I think Copilot's freaking brilliant. I think it's really good. And this particular example, I think, is how AI is going to show up everywhere relatively quickly. And I think it's super cool. I obviously am not a cybersecurity professional. I don't have any perspective on using this. But in terms of where I think we're going to see this stuff show up, here, it's a great example of it and may make us all more secure because God knows we could use it.
I am going to ask. Oh, no, please, Abrar. And then I have a question for all of you.
I was going to say, all I want is for Outlook to be more usable. And so can we add, can I just search my email and find it? Like, that's all I want.
For real, right?
That's my only suggestion.
Yeah. Yeah.
Outlook, bad for you too. Yeah. So the question that I have for everyone, and prepare yourselves, everybody, but I'll start with Abrar. What Copilot do you wish you had right now? So in a world where you get to have someone make you a tech Copilot, where, and it can be for anything, where do you wish you had this AI Copilot helping you out day to day?
Oh, that's a really good question. Day to day. Well, I'll give a, well, that's kind of boring.
It's okay.
I was going to say for like work, like if it was for work, I would love to just like I would love to brainstorm story ideas.
Ooh,
with,
yeah.
Like, wouldn't that be fun? Just to kind of have like a, and just like angles.
Yeah. A little rubber ducky. What is that? That's not the word. There's
the developer thing,
a sounding board. That's a thing.
Right.
I think the term I'm looking for. Yeah. Right. Just, hey, this is an idea that I have. And then it's like, oh, that's a great idea. But have you thought about this? And it just sort of tweaks the idea a little bit. Yeah. That's a good copilot.
That would be helpful.
Story copilot. Christina, what's your copilot?
Okay. So, I mean, I do actually use GitHub Copilot all the time. That is a plug, but it's also, it's really good. And I do use that with work a lot. And it's, and we don't advertise that it works for pros, but it actually does work pretty well for pros. Although I mostly use it for creating demos. I would love a cleaning copilot.
Oh, so is it like, oh no, I just got this. I squeezed a turnip and the juice landed on my pants and I need to know how to get the stain out.
But it would more be like, okay, I'm going to see the state of what rooms are right now and I'm going to help you prioritize like an actual plan to get the most out of doing like your cleaning and like your laundry and other stuff. Like honestly, like
yes!
I need like a clean, I need like a, you know, a Marie Kondo, like sort of like copilot.
Oh my God. Yes. An organizational cleaning space. Oh my God. Yes. Let's get on that for sure. And Alex, what's your copilot?
I'm just blown away by how good the first two are because I would absolutely use both of them. For me, though, the thing that I've really long wanted and I'm hoping is going to be now possible is an OS level buddy. Mm-hmm. I want to be writing and then look at 18 tabs that I pulled up in my extra Chrome window to read later and just be like, OS, can you just put those away into a file for me? I'm going to ask them for them back a little bit later on, but they're killing my RAM. And it would go, sure, Alex. And here's why I think this is not going to be possible, because ChatGPT can ingest natural language and it can and do stuff and it can make code. So why can't it take my words and then use Zapier or whatever and plug into applications, right?
Yeah.
And then just write code or send little magic bits through the tubes and then do stuff for me. And then it's smart enough that it should work most of the time because my stuff that I need isn't complex. It's mostly just very basic stuff, but I'm very busy and I'm in a hurry. So that's what I want. But if I can't have that, I will take cleaning bot or story bot, to be clear, because those would be awesome.
Those are both
No, I love that, Alex. And honestly, like you could also like plug that into like Obsidian or another one of those like second brain apps and be like, okay, put all this stuff here and but bring up that document that I was looking at last week that was talking about this.
Yeah.
I love that. And it could do it. You're exactly right. The technology is there. We just need to be able to have like maybe localized trained models of like just train it on everything that's on my computer.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, like recently, and this works sometimes, but it didn't work this time. I looked at my phone and I hit the little power button to get Siri to pull up. Mm-hmm. And I was like, Siri, please play X by artist Y on Spotify. And it went, working on it, and failed. Right. And I'm like, Lord above, I remember when you bought Siri like 15 years ago and it still can't play a song.
Right.
So all that technology is trash. Just throw it away.
Yep.
And then just use GPT's ability to ingest and kick out text and have that double as code and then do stuff. Why not?
Yeah.
Why doesn't that work now?
And also be able to play our Taylor Tunes playlist on Apple Music, which is my Apple Music playlist of every single Taylor Swift like song and single from everything. So, yeah.
Can I just say to the Swifties here, I love it when I pull up Spotify now and I'm playing the new album and it says at the bottom, copyright, not Republic, not RCA, not Capitol Records. It says copyright, Taylor Swift.
Our queen.
She does it. Queen.
I am so happy for all of you. And I'm so happy for these ideas. My bot would be basically the wire cutter, but as an AI chatbot. So anytime I have a problem and I'm thinking about buying something, I ask it and it's like, here is the one that you should probably get because it's good for your budget, but is also good enough to do this and also has these two extra. Like, it will take what the wire cutter knows, but also all the thousands of other sites out there and use all of that together to recommend me the best thing for me specifically. Right. Yeah.
You know, what it would say is, the best thing for your needs is X, but I checked your Citibank account and you can have Y.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it's like, this would be, you wish you could have this.
Right. Exactly, I'll pay later.
It's just going to shame you a lot and be like, if you considered increasing your income to afford better shoes?
It would literally go, what are those? I thank you for those of you who got that. I do wish that I could increase or decrease the like personality of my AI in the same way that I can with Carrot Weather. So for those of you who have not used the Carrot Weather app, it's this weather app for iPhone and other devices. And you can kind of, it has these little responses that it gives and you can make it more or less snarky. And I do like when it sort of says mean things. Okay, this is getting weird, but I like what it says mean things to me. And I kind of wish that I could get my AI bot to have a little bit more of a personality as well. So then in that case, it would say, don't buy those shoes. You don't need them.
You ever accidentally tell more about your personality than you meant to in the middle of a podcast?
Yeah, just then. I wish I had an AI bot that was like, whoa, slow down, Micah. What you're about to say is not for anyone to hear.
Yeah. It's like when you try to send a tweet with profanity and Twitter's like, people don't like tweets that use these words.
Yeah. Please don't say this. It's just going to embarrass everyone, but especially you.
Can I just say, though, that all of this that we're talking about, I don't see why it isn't possible in the next 5 years. Christina would need cameras in her rooms to have ingest images and stuff. But the story bot would just want to read your past covers and say, well, you also talked about this, you know, 6 months ago. Does that have any pertinence?
Right.
And I'll just call Micah and tell him no. That would be good enough.
So. I was going to say, mine would be possible with, I think the only thing that it'd need to have is just a more recent database than September 2021. So if it had a more recent database than September 2021, I've pretty much already got mine, other than it doesn't have access to my banking information. But I honestly feel okay with that. So I would want it to do it based on everything but financial means, because I want to keep that to myself. So I think mine's possible in its current state. Alex, is yours possible?
I don't know why it isn't. Because if it was, people would build it, I think, right?
No, I mean, I think the idea is, I think you probably have to do it at the OS level, right? Mm-hmm. But I definitely think there's, I mean, presumably somebody could build like an application that had full access to everything to do it. But I think you could. But I think it would be one of those things, like, because basically we're just talking about, like, on the Mac, for instance, we would just be kind of talking about, like, Automator voice, right? Like, like something that they could, you know, use natural language to pull up, you know, the sorts of search things or to, you know, run macros, you know, that you're trying to accomplish. It definitely seems like it should be possible.
Yeah, but just add little hooks in every app,
yeah,
right,
for
the
thing
to talk and pull and put things back
into. Which AppleScript basically already has. At least on a Mac. That's what I'm saying. So basically it would just be kind of a way of, like, you know, making like Apple Script, you know,
on the fly. Yeah.
On the fly with your voice.
And that's what I mean when I'm talking about those large language models, is it's not just ingest. It's well, I don't want to talk about what that outjest. We'll go with that. It's
egress.
Yeah, thank egress. You. Egress. It is taking the translation of what you're saying in, and then it's also able to then go from that and also tell the other thing. It talks in their languages too. That's what I think makes this so incredible, and why what you're talking about seems entirely possible, because as long as it has the context of this is how I have to talk to the machine, luckily with macOS, we do have a lot of those hooks already built in. It's just no one is able to write every single kind of program they need to do to use the system. But if the AI could do that on the fly, then that would work. Yeah.
Did you guys read the iOS 16.4 story that was in the prep sheet for today's show? And did you fall asleep reading it because it was so fantastically boring? Oh my gosh, new emojis. Blah. Mobile OSs have been figured out to the current level of technology. And frankly, every time I update my Mac to a new whatever, it feels the exact same. And Windows 11 is Windows 10 with the button moved to the middle. Okay, whatever. The first OS that gets what we're describing correct and functional is going to win.
Yeah,
and we are dying for something new. And this is it. And I'm curious to know when it comes and how good is it in the first iteration, and does it steal Micah's credit card information? Apparently, I think we're going there, and I think it's going to be awesome, especially for people who have low visibility, mm-hmm. or limited hearing, mm-hmm. or speak a language that most computer programs are written in. It's going to be huge for accessibility, and I think it's going to open up computing to a lot more folks, and it's going to make our lives better. So I'm pretty hyped.
Hype as can be. You know what else I'm hype about? It's Club Twit. You out there can join the club at twit.tv/clubtwit. And when you do, you are going to get a lot of great things. Our club is available for starting at $7 a month or $84 a year. And joining the club gets you access to ad-free episodes of every single Twit show, which is awesome. It's just all the content, none of the extra stuff, because you, in effect, are the sponsor. You are supporting the show. And so in doing so, we say, hey, these are the ad-free episodes of all of the Twit shows. You also get access to the Twit Plus bonus feed that has extra content you won't find anywhere else. Behind the scenes, before the show, after the show, the events we hold in the club are often published there. It's a great feed of so much extra stuff that, you know, when you join, you get to look back through and find the things that you want. You also get access to the members-only Discord server. That is a place where you can go to chat with your fellow Club Twit members, but also those of us here at Twit. It is constantly popping, as they say. There's a lot going on in there. There are so many different channels where you can chat about different subjects. Many of the hosts here are regularly there. My co-host for iOS Today, her name is Rosemary Orchard, and she is regularly answering questions in the club as well. So that's a great place if you're wanting to develop a shortcut and you are trying to figure out how to make it work. Rosemary Orchard is often there answering those questions. And you may have heard me say starting at $7 a month. That's because some folks, they were like, hey, you know, honestly, you keep adding more stuff to the club and we feel like we would like to pay more than $7 a month because there's more value here than that. So we flipped the right switch and you can choose starting at $7 to sort of make your subscription what you want. So if you want to give $8 a month or $9 or whatever, you're able to do that. And I think part of the reason why that's the case is because as we've continued with the club, we've added more and more to it and we'll continue to do so. So there's the Untitled Linux show that's Club Twit exclusive. It is a show all about Linux. We've also got Hands on Windows, which is a great program from Paul Thurrott that is tips and tricks all about Windows. You've got my show, Hands on Mac, another Club Twit exclusive, short format show, meaning, you know, 10, 15, 20 minutes episodes that are covering tips and tricks for not just the Mac, but also iOS and iPadOS, as well as Scott Wilkinson's Home Theater Geeks, which is relaunched by way of the club. So if you have home theater stuff that you are curious about, or, you know, you're thinking about your next purchase there, then Home Theater Geeks is a great place to go and learn more about that. So if that sounds good to you, please head to twit.com twit.tv/clubtwit and join the club. And thank you, thank you, thank you from the bottom of my heart and all of us here at Twit for choosing to be subscribers. You help keep this thing rolling along. You can keep the AC running so I don't die of heat stroke here in the studio. So thank you for that, all of you. And yeah, after you join the club, please let us know how you like it. And Aunt Pruitt, the community manager, is always on the lookout, making sure that we're providing the best experience possible. And with that, I think it's time to see what took place on Twit this week.
This is a good answer. I asked it, who said mistakes were made? The phrase mistakes were made is often used in politics and business to acknowledge that something went wrong without taking responsibility for it.
Honest to God.
It's like what it says here.
Are you open yet? It's like, well, we usually open at 9:30, but listen, it was a yes or no question, honey. Are you open? just
let me just ask.
I just want to get to the point.
Why is Paul Thurrott so angry? I do not have enough information about that person to help with your request.
Previously on Twit, all about Android.
The headline of my latest Samsung Galaxy S23 review is: Samsung's Galaxy S23 is one of the best small Android phones you can buy right now. The camera algorithms on the S23 are so much better than they were on the last generation S22.
This week in space.
We're joined by Colonel Eileen Collins of the U.S. Air Force, the first woman to pilot and command a space shuttle.
Think about the stars. Set yourself like exciting goals, something that is possible, but set high goals and try to make a path to get there.
Security now.
Microsoft has started testing a cryptocurrency wallet, which they're planning to build into their Edge browser.
Wow.
And an assets tab will let you stare lovingly at your NFTs.
Twit.
Which is all you can do with them. So good. Yeah, good. I'm glad.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, I keep like 5 to 10 NFTs here in my jacket. If anybody would like one, I can pass those out after the show. They'll disappear before they make it to you. They're actually self-destructing NFTs, but, you know.
Oh, man. That's kind.
By their very nature. I thought we could end the show by talking about everybody's least favorite social media platform. It's Twitter. So there's been a lot kind of coming out since the open sourcing of Twitter's code, or at least parts of its code, and also the sort of changes that have and in some cases have not taken place when it comes to Twitter Blue. There were some specific Twitter accounts that had kind of their own little portion in Twitter code. So depending on which author it was, it could mean that their tweets were getting boosted and shown to more people than others. Platformer has a list of Twitter VIPs that were getting boosted over everyone else, including NBA All-Star LeBron James, Ben Shapiro, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, or AOC, and President Joe Biden, as well as conservative commentator Cat Turd 2. Am I out of the loop? I didn't know there was someone named Cat Turd 2 who was needing to be boosted to lots of people.
Well, then you don't follow Donald Trump's Truths. Sorry, over on Truth Social, where he's been citing a recent, and I hate to say this out loud if there are kids in the room, Cat Turd poll, in which he won over Ron DeSantis, and he's been quoting it, and it is surreal.
this is where we really are. That Cat Turd 2's polling is being cited by presidential candidates on their Twitter alternative social networks because they were banned from Twitter for 2 years. They're allowed back now, but they don't want to be back.
Right, because Truth is part of Truth Social, which is part of the Trump Media and Technology Group, which was going to merge with another company in a SPAC combination, but now that's under investigation for shenanigans.
Right.
Right, 2023. I hope your bingo card's full.
I feel like someone just took printed out a web page from TechCrunch, cut it up into little pieces, and then added in like a Mad Libs, and we're just pulling these little words out of a hat and just putting them together because I'm so lost here.
Don't mock my writing process.
Well, also, I was going to say, Anne added some ChatGPT to it, so
yeah, that's going on too. I mean. Yeah. So I don't know this when I saw this and I saw similar I remember seeing something specifically where it was showing parts of the code and it had author is.
Because the recommendation algorithm or whatever is now on GitHub I'm not talking about the leaked one.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about
the other one.
That was the thing from last week where there was a DMCA takedown notice. I don't know. I'm talking about like the actual thing. Like Twitter's uploaded stuff. It's on GitHub, and then people were going through the code in real time. Or like, hey, Elon, how come you're getting boosted so much more? Why are you here? And he is like, I don't know. This is a complete shock to me. cut to stories. I think also from Platformer several weeks ago, where like engineers were basically instructed. Make sure Elon is coming, that his engagement is high because he's looking at his numbers very closely. And if they fall, he doesn't want to hear that. So they're like, all right, well, I guess we better put him on everybody's For You page because we got to give him, you know, all the feels.
You know what I hate is the TikTokification of every single service. I don't want a For You page. My Twitter feed is selected by me. I don't want Spotify to become TikTok. But we need to go back. Abrar, can you say the name of Twitter's owner out loud for us,
yes,
please?
Thank you. Let's go down the list.
Elon Musk.
Okay, so I go with the Elon, and then Christina, can you say it again?
Elon. I say it the wrong way, yeah.
But that's a French word, E-L-A-N with a little kick over the A. It means something entirely different. This is like I call my company Yahoo, and no one appreciates it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I've never heard that.
Once again, is now we've switched to like some sort of blog about languages and we're cutting out words from it. I did want to, but to go back to this, were any of you surprised by this? I don't think like this just seemed obvious to me that some Twitter accounts were like in the algorithm part of things. Of course, if I had learned that in my timeline that was just reverse chronological, they were somehow boosting things. That's a different story. But the algorithm, did anyone believe that it was anything other than it's most popular and also just those that they choose to be most popular? Or were we really hoping and believing and thinking that this was just completely, these are the most engaged tweets on the platform? Was it a surprise to anybody?
No, but I think the brazenness in which this was like, and to be clear, I'm not at all suggesting that this started with Elon. See, I'll say it, I'll say it the way that everyone else says it that way. I'm not at all trying to suggest that it started with Elon, but Elon, whatever.
Say it your way. I like it.
All right. Elon, I'm not saying that it started with him, but I am, there clearly have been changes and you can see it. It's funny in where they literally have it. The project title is the algorithm. that's what it's called in the Twitter, the organization on GitHub. But just to see the brazenness about some of this is just see like, yes, these people and especially this small man does have to be boosted. Like, that's just really funny to me.
It feels different than like TikTok's algorithm, right? Mm-hmm. So I feel like TikTok's algorithm, you see something and you're like, this was meant to reach me. Like, thank
correct.
God. Like, you know, and you feel good about it and you feel like, you know, all the stars have aligned. And with Twitter, I scroll through the For You page and I'm like, why? Like, sometimes I'm like, okay, great. But I feel like it feels a lot more forced. And especially reading this, seeing how forced it really is, it feels inauthentic. And it just makes being on Twitter that much more miserable, I feel like.
Yeah, you look at it and it's like, you don't understand me. And if you're trying to say you do, then you're making me feel bad about myself if this is the person that I am coming across as. Whereas TikTok, it's like, oh man, you just get me, don't you? I just feel so
right. Right. No, I was going to say, I'm with Alex. I don't like the TikTokification of everything, but that's mostly because these other places can't do it as well as TikTok does.
Yeah.
So it's just like a bad version. Right. So I'm like, well, no, TikTok actually does get me and it freaks me out sometimes, but I love it. Whereas like this no, this is your idea of what you think based on something. Even the YouTube algorithm gets me pretty well. Like, and I like it because it changes a lot, because I'll get into other things and it'll be like, oh, remember this thing from 6 months ago? But it'll be like a one-off. It'll know not to show me stuff that I was really into 2 years ago. But yeah, you're exactly right. The Twitter thing, it's just, yeah, it just doesn't work.
Oh, they've done a bad job, and they should feel bad.
Exactly.
Speaking of that, the another thing I think they've done a bad job with is the sort of changes in Twitter Blue. And we have seen not only several news organizations and other publications actually say, there's no way we're going to be paying for this special type of check mark on the platform. But we've also seen several celebrities who are saying too, no, we won't be doing that. And I wonder, because we talked, when we talk about sort of the moves that a company is making, a lot of the time you see a company, once they've announced that decision, they really do move forward with it. But because of the fragility of the of Elmo, then you have a situation where it's incredibly mercurial, incredibly volatile, and who knows what will happen. So I'm curious, do you think there's going to be another change for Twitter Blue if all of the people that they would hope would be part of this $1,000 or however much it is, it might even be more than that, subscription service? How are they going to, this doesn't seem to be a way that they're going to make a lot of money if all of the news organizations are going, nah, not for us.
Are you trying to say that someone who's very good at one thing may not be good at another thing?
I may be saying that. Yeah. If I put that together, yeah. 1 + 1 = 3. Yeah.
It's either a Charlie Munger or a Warren Buffett quote, but they said, and I'm going to paraphrase here, when someone who has a reputation for being good at business goes into an industry that has a reputation for being a bad place to do business, the reputation of the business itself usually is the one that wins out. Mm. And social media is a hard place to be. Twitter's always been the kind of like sickly child of the major social media platforms. It was doing medium before he bought it and loaded it up with debt. And now it's struggling. And I think this is death flails from someone trying to figure out how to pay off $14 billion without selling off their Tesla stock. But I mean, I paid for Twitter Blue originally because I wanted to support my home on the internet. Like, you know, when Reddit launched Gold, I contributed when it came out because I used Reddit, you know, and so I was here for it. But when Elon made it a referendum on your approval of his personality, I was out.
Yeah.
And same. I think that a lot of folks, much like how I probably wouldn't buy a Tesla now because I don't want to be conflated with an Elon stan, you know, I think he's seen the other side of the cult of personality here.
Can I tell you, I quite literally had that. So this was how much it was affecting me in that moment, what you're talking about, not being conflated with an Elon stan. I had met some new friends, and a lot of the people that I spend time around don't have Twitter. And so on the rare occasion when there is someone who does have Twitter, I'm always very excited and I want to follow them and, you know, make that. And so I found out that my friend had Twitter and I was about to follow him on Twitter. And then I had this realization, they're going to see this blue check and they're going to think I'm an Elon supporter and that I'm like paying for this service. And so I was like, you know what? I'm just going to write. I'm going to feel like an idiot doing so, but I'm going to write like a paragraph going, so listen, I really want to follow you. But then I had this moment where I thought, if I follow you, you're going to do it. And so I did. And I sent it to them and they thought it was hilarious and were like, oh no, you know, I wasn't worried about that or whatever. And it's fine. But yeah, I didn't want to be conflated with that. And so that was kind of the anti-branding that was in place there. And now it's all up in the air anyway. In terms of will these blue check marks stay or will they go, and will any of it matter going forth? Because it sounds like every time we're all logging onto the platform, a lot of times it just makes us not feel very good. And I don't find myself I still have it and I still occasionally open the app, but I don't find myself tweeting all that often. I don't find myself checking into the app all that often. And I don't know, have any of you, because I think, Christina, I have not seen you do much on like Mastodon. No, are you using any other platforms?
No, I'm on Mastodon.
You are?
And I'm on Mastodon fairly frequently, but it's a weird thing. It's like when I had to step off from Twitter a little bit, just because, frankly, A, the algorithm got worse. Like, so even the suggested things and the stuff that I would see got demonstrably worse. So it was like, it's not bad enough that they're trying to copy TikTok, but they're doing a worse job than they even used to do when they were copying Instagram. So, you know, when engagement and other stuff is messed up, and then like a certain chunk of your social graph goes away and you're like, where are they now? And so I, kind of, it's a consequence to all of that is that I'm not like as engaged with all those things. Mm-hmm. It's weird because I can still be on Mastodon for all of like my tech stuff, and that's great. And there's a great community there. But none of my memes are there. None of my pop culture is there. None of my Swifties are there. And so I can't get into like the ridiculous stuff that happens. And so you still kind of have to be there, but it does feel like my home is died, or at least it's been blown up, and we're now like, you know, in rebuilding, but we don't really like the new dictator. And like you, I used to pay for Twitter Blue because mm-hmm. I wanted to support my home. And I've been verified for a very long time, and it had nothing to do with that. I was like, no, I had a lot of friends who worked at Twitter, and I knew people who were working on things. It was like, I want to support, like people have always said, you know, if you like something, pay for it. I want to actually put my, you know, money where my mouth is. And I did it happily. And now like he's even ruined that because you don't want to, you know, this thing that was, it's so funny. This thing that was a status symbol for a lot of people is no longer a status symbol. It's an anti-status symbol. And then this plan to get people to pay for accounts, you know, you have people who are some of your biggest users who are like, absolutely not. Although what is interesting, and some of my own reporting had borne this out too, was that there were a number of publications who were getting, and other big companies who were getting, they got emails, you know, like last month or something, basically being like, hey, we will give you your free gold verified handle, and you can have up to 5 affiliate accounts. But if you want to have more than that, then you're going to have to pay $1,000 a month and $50 per affiliate. So they were already kind of seeding to, I'm assuming, their biggest advertisers to try to keep them involved. But it is very interesting to see all these celebrities and like big publishers being like, no, we're not going to pay. Now, a number of them, I'm sure, were already getting them for free because they were advertisers. But it is seeing how like you really are like, cutting off your nose to spite your face to get that $96 a year. It's going great.
On top of the verified check marks kind of losing all meaning, I remember when we were all notified that we could only have 2FA if we were Twitter Blue subscribers.
Yes.
I was like, okay, so I'm risking my online security because I'm not paying $8 a month for Twitter Blue. Like, it's just like, it's been going downhill for a while, and I don't know how sustainable it all is, really.
Yeah, we had someone call earlier in to ask the tech guys, and this person had a Twitter handle that was a pretty common one. And so she would regularly get the emails that said, you know, your Twitter account you're trying to reset your Twitter account. Here's the, you know, use this to change your password or whatever. And so because of that, she had concerns that someone would attempt to hack her Twitter account, just in general. So she had two-factor authentication turned on. So then when Twitter made this change, she was getting a notification that was saying, hey, we're sending you your two-factor authentication code. She would type it in. But then as soon as she went in, it would not let her use her account until she turned off two-factor authentication. But because she had a very common Twitter handle, she was worried that in that period of time where she went to make the change from using a phone number to using the code, that someone would somehow gain access to her account and be, you know, take control of it. And so I like had this moment of just, you know, sadness thinking about someone who is, you know, so concerned and wants to be as protected as they possibly can be online, who then has this moment of going, what do I do in this situation? And it adds unnecessary fear and FUD, as it were, that I don't think needs to be there. And all because of, you know, looking for more ways to bring in money that hasn't happened for the company, frankly, yet.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I think it'll be interesting to compare this to Meta Verified. And I'm surprised that another company kind of borrowed that model, but like, you know, they're not taking away people's legacy check marks. Yep. But I think it'll be really interesting to see how they kind of navigate that and how they take that business model and compare that to what ends up happening with Twitter.
Yeah. No, I think that's a great point. And the interesting thing about Meta Verified, I think that on the one hand, like, it's just an easier way for people who really want to have that verified Instagram or Facebook thing to do it. But B, they are ostensibly offering a little bit of like a value add by basically saying, you will have better customer service and we'll respond to you more. And so if you were a business or someone, you could kind of see that as being worth paying for. I'm worried that it feels a little bit kind of like a bait and switch thing where they're going to be like, hey, verified people will show up more in your feed. And so isn't this a great way for your business to be more visible on Facebook or whatever? Mm-hmm. But I mean, whatever. That is what it is. But it the way they're doing it seems to be make much more sense than whatever this Twitter thing is. And the latest rumor, and I don't know how true any of this is, I've asked some of my friends who used to work in Twitter engineering and have not been able to confirm this, but the rumor is that the reason that they can't just like run like a mass like script to de-verify everyone is that that would break a bunch of other things. So it has to be a manual process. And so you can imagine like the pain and who knows how many places it has to be changed. So you can imagine the amount of work that would entail that is probably going to be left to one engineer who has 16 other jobs because most of the engineering staff is gone. So who even knows how long it will be before we lose our blue checks, you know, if that even happens at all.
What a night. And yeah. I thought about this too. The other thing is like, I hope that somewhere there are backups of all of this, because what happens in the future if the company ends up surviving its current state and is in the hands of someone who's trying to keep it going and bring it to a place that it once was at its heyday or what have you. And then all of that information that came along with those verifications and everything that was involved with that legacy data, I guess, is just gone because there's so much that's been messed about as things have changed. Just in general, that sort of loss of a timeline of information is kind of sad to me. I understand the internet is volatile, but it's in some ways it is a history of humanity from the point of the internet on. And so, yeah, that kind of is upsetting.
I mean, I've been on Twitter since 2008, I think. You know, that was when my age started with a one, which was now pretty far, you know, in the past. So my whole adult life, you know, I've been on Twitter.
Same.
I've sent out hundreds of thousands of tweets. I had deleted my tweets a couple of times and they were always in the six figures, which is embarrassing. But there's nothing else still. I mean, I love y'all. Mastodon's trash. I don't want to use it. It's too hard. I couldn't figure it out. It was too different. I just want tweets. I just want Twitter. That's all I want. It works for me. It works for my brain, my workflow. I don't read email. I read tweets. Like that's what I have up on my screen. And just losing, like recently my Twitter client Tweetin stopped working. I now have to use this crappy web tweet deck thing. It's just getting worse and worse and worse. And there's going to come a day when I realize that it is no longer for me and my brain worth it. And then I'm just going to have a Substack, which is fine. Right. But
we've lost our home. No, I mean, cause it's a similar thing. Like I've been on Twitter for 16 years and you know, like, some of the Mastodon apps are better, like Elk.Zone is a very, very good web interface.
Elk.Zone? What am I going, buck hunting?
Basically, but what's great about it is basically they've recreated the Twitter interface back before the Twitter interface became bad. So that's really good. There's Ivory, which is Tweetbot, but for Mastodon. So there are some things that are better, but I'm not going to at all try to argue with you that it is better. I mean, and you're Alex, you're part of like the first name club, you know, so your account, I'm sure you've been trying to get like hacked, you know, many, many times over the years.
All those emails go to a Gmail account. I don't check.
Nice.
Exactly. I had the opportunity to be at Christina, but I didn't want to like pull clout and make them give it to me, and I should have, and I still regret this like 14 years later. But there is nothing else. We're just all kind of going to all these other diasporas
and trying services. Them I that's what I keep trying doing them. Is trying to see if anything else matches what my experience has been on Twitter. I think I joined in November of 2008. And yeah, it has been my home. It's where I've had, you know, it's my biggest following. It is where I have made a lot of the contacts that resulted in my current you know, what I do now. And it, yep. I love Twitter and what is provided. I think I've just kind of gone, I've crawled away from the internet in general in terms of sort of sharing and consuming. And so that's why I don't find myself on it or other platforms. And I just, I'm in all the different places, but I'm just not using any of them. And I wish that I had that original experience that I had with Twitter back. I did want to ask if anyone has joined or attempted to join T2, which is made by some former engineers. Twitter, yeah.
I signed up yesterday because I heard they were giving free blue checks, yeah, to all of the legacy blue checks.
That's what I did, so, too, just for that reason.
So I did send off a thing to that, but I don't know. I haven't checked my email to see if I got anything.
At T2.social, for folks who are listening, is the name of it. And yes, if you have a legacy verified account, then you basically can have that like confirmed. I think you send them a direct message with a specific word or whatever, and then it'll kind of bring it over. So I joined the platform because I saw that, and they have basically, in the interviews that they've taken, they've said, kind of like what Instagram did whenever they were talking about how they copied Snapchat stories, where they're just like, yeah, we're copying Snapchat. T2 has kind of said the same thing. Yeah, it's pretty much just a wholesale copy of Twitter in its original state. So that part sounded promising, but I don't know. It doesn't seem like any of these are catching on as a whole, and none of it feels like Twitter once did, ultimately.
All right, I joined the wait list. I'm in.
Nice. Well,
I'm not in yet, but I'll be there. And maybe this will be the one.
Maybe. Who knows?
Remember FriendFeed? That was fun.
FriendFeed was great. I mean, yeah. That's what got Brett Taylor to Facebook. I know. I was going to say, if everybody, on this thing, you know. I was going to say, if anybody does. But FriendFeed was great.
I shouldn't be dismissive about arcane facts that normal people don't have in their brain because they weren't covering social media back in the dark ages. Christina makes a very good point.
Yes, it is. It is a very good point. I think we've done it. We have given Alex enough time to not have to let the baby go to sleep, hopefully.
There's no way she's down. She won't be down until 9:30. I'm just joining the war on the second act.
Well, that means there'll be lots of music to listen to, right? Lots of Taylor Swift. So that's good, at least.
There's a new acoustic version of Lavender Haze. So
I haven't gotten to hear it yet, but I'm so excited. Well, there you go. That's something you can look forward to. Well, Christina Warren, Senior Developer Advocate at GitHub. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me. It's so good to be on. So good to be with you on your first show. It's hosting. Big share. I love it.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And Alex Wilhelm, reporter at TechCrunch, who has a much longer title that he didn't want to share with us today. Haver of a great bookcase and listener of many a Swift song. Thank you for your time.
All that's lovely. I just want to say, doubling what Christina just said, you did a lovely job. It's a big chair to sit in. We all know exactly how Leo sounds and how he goes through things. So I've been on your other show on the network, but I think you did a fantastic job today. So thanks for having me, and let's do it again.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Alex. And last but certainly not least, video host and producer for CNET, I just think you're great, Abrar Alhidi. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much. I want to echo what they both said. You are such an incredible host, and it's such an honor to be on your first show doing this. So thank you for having us.
Thanks, everybody. Going to have me all tearing up here at the end. I appreciate it and sincerely appreciate your time. I know this can be a real long show. And so, on a Sunday, it means a lot that you're here to join me to talk tech. This has been This Week in Tech. I will have another, of course, This Week in Tech next week with another host while Leo is out. But thank you all out there for joining us for this episode. And I hope you have a great geek week. Yeah, I'm saying the thing that Leo usually says at the end of Ask the Tech Guys at the end of This Week in Tech because I didn't get to say it earlier. So goodbye, everybody. Thank you for joining us.
You didn't say, and that's another twit.
Oh, another twit is in the can.
There you go.